All of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
They don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking with our good friend, attorney Erwin Aronson, about the, you know, what's going on this past weekend, the meaning of Labor Day, the assault on the middle class, and what to expect as the Pennsylvania legislature reconvenes and begins the assault that we know is coming and we've been talking about for some time. So that ought to be interesting. Also in the second hour, Jeffrey Kidder, author of the book Urban Flow, Bike Messengers and the City, going to be here talking about his book and, you know, what it's like to be a bike messenger, the kind of job, you know, the conditions, the hours, the wages, all of that stuff. That ought to be interesting there as well. Paul Cole, also on the program, founder and director of the American Labor Studies Center. They've just released their new report, American Labor in U.S. History Textbooks, How Labor's Story is Distorted in High School Textbooks. And, you know, you look at this and you go, yeah, pretty much. And it's been that way for a couple generations, because the more we're looking at people who are saying, well, we don't need unions anymore. Those are something back in the old days, because that's how it was presented to them. It was something that we needed back then to, you know, to keep people from being killed immediately. Not that we have 50,000 people a year in this country who die of occupational illnesses, because they're exposed to things that they didn't know. They're exposed to things that they couldn't control because they don't have the ability or the voice to stop it. Some 50,000 every year. We don't have a problem. Don't worry about that. That's old stuff. Don't need those unions. Don't need that collective bargaining. Don't need none of that. We're so much better than that now. We're so advanced. We're so much intellectual. We're so smart. We're individuals. We can take care of ourselves. And yet, 50,000 people a year. 50,000. So it'll be interesting to talk about that. Because I got to be honest, I think, much like in Wisconsin, every state should have in their curriculum labor history. That should be like world history. That should be like American history. It should be right there, because it is part of what made this country. And, you know, as in what I wrote in my op-ed, that generation created this massive middle class. And that didn't happen because, we were good little workers and we came to work every day and the boss just liked us so much and patted us on the head and said, oh, good worker, here, you've been so good. We, the benevolent force, gonna give everything to you. Gonna just hand it to you on this silver platter, very nicely coated. Didn't happen that way. But the way history has been taught is that, you know, the benevolent corporation, as they profited, they willingly shared their profits with everyone. They spread the wealth around. Which any rational, logical thinking person would know that's total bunk. But it's what's being sold. And it's what our kids are learning. And it's what we learned. I mean, I remember learning nothing about labor history in high school. I remember learning virtually nothing. The Molly Maguires. And it was negative. They were criminals. And they were hanged. That's what I remember. That's it. Nothing about the Latimer Massacre, nothing about the Pullman strikes, nothing about any of the free speech fights, nothing about labor and the civil rights movement, none of that. Nothing. So when Labor Day comes, most of us don't know what to do. We're just happy to have a day off. Because we don't know the history. We don't know the people who fought, bled, and died so that we could have a better future. And we do an awful good job. We do. We do a great job of memorializing the war dead. The people we fight off, we send off to fight our wars, we kind of remember them. But the people who fought the wars on the job, not so much. There are a couple of places that I know of, the National Labor College in Silver Spring, Maryland. They have a monument to people who were killed on the job. That I know of, and there are a couple other ones around the country that kind of memorialize it a little bit. Up in Latimer, there's the marker on the side of the road that memorializes the 19 who were shot dead, most of them in the back, by the sheriff's deputies, all because they wanted to walk to the next colliery to protest the treatment of workers in mines. But, you know, just a sign on the road. Amazing stuff. So, are you surprised by all the right-wing rhetoric coming around the Hoffa comments? You know, we had Teamster President James Hoffa here on the program last night. Came out and said, look, you know, I stand by what I said. The reality is there's class war going on here, and it's about time that someone speak up and fight back. And the right is just losing their mind. You got a guy like Alan West. Understand, Alan West. Some of the most toxic language that you could possibly ever imagine flows out of the mouth of Alan West. And yet he's out there saying, well, you know, America is no place for harsh rhetoric. We have no place for harsh rhetoric in politics. Really? This guy gonna have the audacity, the stones, the gall? And the answer is yes. And I'm shocked. Maybe not really. I mean, the Tea Party has, what they've done is they've now seized on this factual inaccuracy. Because, you know, again, you know, the clip that Fake News on Fox put out, which, again, I liked, you know, this one, and you gotta love it, or maybe not, basically saying, you know what, you know, we're gonna go out there, we're gonna take these people out. We're going to get them out, and we're going to take this country back. And, you know, the reality is I'm in favor of that. But what he actually said is we're going to go to the ballot box, we're going to vote, we're going to make sure that we get these people out. Nothing toxic. He used the SOB word, which I think really shocked people. Oh, gee, you know, someone actually said something like that. Someone's angry. And I don't know if you've seen many of the Tea Party rallies. I don't know if you've paid attention much to that. But there's some pretty toxic language there. I don't know if you remember the Sarah Palin thing with the crosshairs all over the congressional districts. That seems kind of violent to me. I don't know if you remember hearing last night talking about the Koch brothers calling President Obama Saddam Hussein. And saying that he must be defeated in the mother of all wars. That's, you know, I guess not. I guess since he's a billionaire and he has all of this money to buy people, I guess that's okay. The fact that you've got a labor leader who has finally stood up and said, you know, I've had enough, and I've been waiting for somebody to stand up and say, well, pretty much had enough of this. It's time now to fight back. And now understand, I really never thought that the Republicans would do what they've done. I never really thought that they would come after labor with guns blaring. And the reason why is they've been slowly picking away at it. Slowly picking away at it. And labor had, you know, just trying to protect what's theirs. You know, just trying to, you know, to keep the boat afloat. Now what the right has done is they've backed everybody into a corner. And even the Republican union members are going, well, wait a minute. That means me. They're coming after me. And their families are going, wait a second, that means we're not going to have jobs either. So what I think's happened, and you know, this is actually a good thing for labor. And Democrats better get their heads out of their behinds and jump onto this bandwagon. Because working people are starting to realize that the Republicans, and if you've watched this debate, man, it's, wow, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, way out on an island somewhere, just really adrift somewhere from reality. But what they want is they want exploitable cheap labor here. We're going to create jobs no matter what it takes, no matter if we have to destroy the environment, no matter if we have to, you have to breathe, we have to cut air with a knife or drink brown water, we're going to create jobs. And if they're minimum wage jobs, so be it. At least they're jobs. Everybody has something. And I've said it before. I could create millions of jobs tomorrow. Buck an hour. And if you make things desperate enough, you take away that social safety net. You take away all the programs that help keep this economy from collapsing into depression. A buck an hour seems pretty good. Because what else do you have? Well, that or jail. Which at the rate that they're privatizing the jails, and we're going to talk about that later about Ohio, more profit to be made for the very wealthy. So Chris Christie said something that, again, you think of the Hoffa quote, you know, we're going to take these SOBs out. We're going to make sure that we get them. We're going to take the country back. We're going to go in the right direction. And that is incendiary. That's violent rhetoric. Yet when Chris Christie stands up before the Koch brothers and their whole wealth class and says, you know what? Now is the time to take on the teachers union once and for all. Take them on once and for all. That's, you know, that's not heated rhetoric. Take them on and take them out. So you ask the question, what's this attack really about? What are all these attacks on working people really about? It's about money, and you know that. And the latest Gallup poll has reported that 52% of the country approves of labor union. In fact, that's the lowest number since Gallup started keeping this poll since in 1936. And to be honest, it's not surprising that we're seeing an area of great divide. And this is where Democrats had better pull their heads out of their keisters. And for me, this is where the rubber meets the road. And this is why I can never foresee myself voting for any of the current Republicans. Look at the fact, 78% of the Democrats approve of unions. Just 26% of Republicans. And I think it's safe to assume that those 26%, like I said a minute ago, the 26% of Republicans who approve of unions, they're current or former members. They've seen the benefits. They've lived through the benefits. And sadly, they continue to vote against their own best economic interest. But here's the thing. They've got to be seeing what's going on and the attacks that are going against them. You know, I got to be honest. I never thought I'd see the day where you would see a mainstream political party coming out against child labor laws like they did in Missouri and in Maine and in others here in Pennsylvania trying to change the laws here. I never thought I'd see this idea that we can destroy the minimum wage, destroy worker safety laws. If you watch the debate tonight, we're going to talk about that a little bit later. Worker safety laws on the chopping block, but Social Security and Medicare. They want to fundamentally change this country to where my grandparents' generation will not recognize what this country has turned into. What it'll turn into is the Depression era that they grew up in. And that's what frightens me. That, my friends, is what worries me. Anyway, your calls tonight. Want to talk about the debate. Want to talk about the direction of the state, the country. What's on your mind? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend, Erwin Aronson. Back after this.
On the radio, with my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat, it is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m., I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. As President Obama prepares to address the nation at a joint session of Congress on the jobs crisis, labor is urging the president to rise to the challenge of proposing a solution big enough to deal with the true scope of the jobs crisis. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka at a recent Christian Science Monitor forum said that Obama must act in a big way to help create jobs.
Will he focus on bold solutions on the job crisis, or will he continue to work with the Tea Party to offer cuts to middle-class programs like Social Security, all the while pretending that the deficit is where our economic problems really lie?
Trumka says a CBO report shows that letting the Bush tax cuts expire cuts the deficit in half in 10 years. Putting 14 million Americans back to work would erase the deficit, Trumka says. And Trumka says Obama cannot be a Tea Party president by proposing only what Republicans will accept on the jobs crisis.
If you only propose what you think they'll accept, they control the agenda. I urged him to propose what was necessary to solve the problem, and I hope he does that.
While Obama was in Detroit for Labor Day, UAW President Bob King, Teamsters President James Hoffa, and SEIU President Mary Kay Henry published a newspaper column also calling on the president to create a robust jobs program to put America back to work. The Center for American Progress says a GOP presidential candidate Mitt Romney's jobs plan has a fatal flaw: not enough action to stimulate demand. Jesse Russell reports.
In advance of President Barack Obama announcing his jobs plan, Republican candidate and former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney unveiled his own. The plan includes 59 proposals that Romney believes will turn around the economy. However, Center for American Progress Economic Policy Vice President Michael Ettlinger said on Tuesday his organization disagrees, as Romney's plan doesn't do enough to address the lack of demand.
The plan is a doubling down on Bush supply-side policies, which not only have been proven failures, but they're clearly addressing the wrong problems in today's economy.
Ettlinger added that small businesses agree the way to turn around the economy is creating demand.
The National Federation of Independent Business survey consistently says that poor sales, which is lack of demand, is the key problem in today's economy, not taxes or regulation. Federal taxes are at the lowest level they've been in more than 60 years.
The president will unveil his jobs plan Thursday during a joint session of Congress.
This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against the multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
All the things you want are real. You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
Well, you know, I go back to what Hoffa said the other day, and look, it's time. It's time. I like the Fox News clip, and I think their chop job was even better than his speech.
President Obama, this is your army. We are ready to march. Let's take these son of a out and give America back to America where we belong. Thank you very much.
You know, it's time. You know, you look at this debate tonight. I think they are very clear that they want to fundamentally change this country. And you look this day back in 1916, the first time federal employees were able to win the right to receive workers' comp insurance. 1916. They want to go back and change that too. There's a bill right now in the Pennsylvania legislature to fundamentally change people being able to see their doctor by extending the time that they've got to go to the company's doctor. How many people know that? Sad, sad. So we've got our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson, on the line. Erwin, thanks for taking time for me, brother.
Good to be here, Rick. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you faring with the floodwaters that are rising?
Well, they're rising, and we're high and dry up here, but the Susquehanna River is spilling over its banks at Fort Hunter as we speak. I saw that at about 7:30 this evening, and I know that the intersection around the farm show in Harrisburg is underwater, and The river's still rising. So it's a difficult and challenging thing. I understand Governor Corbett, as we speak, is having a press conference from the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency, warning people that we have a problem from his perspective up and down the Susquehanna River Valley and over across into Wilkes-Barre. And it's going to last through the weekend, from what I'm hearing.
Yeah. And, you know, I was watching some of the news reports, and they were showing rescue crews out rescuing people. And I go, you know what? There's government in action. There's smart government at work.
Well, it's not just smart government at work. When everybody else is running away from the problem, it is our public employees that are running into it. And the thanks they get is to have these teabaggers and corporate captains and Republican anarchists all attacking and assaulting them and suggesting that they have to be laid off, that they have to have their pension slashed, that they have to have their access to health care slashed, that their pay should be slashed, and they should be privatized away.
And I look at the quote from Governor Christie back when he was speaking to the Koch brothers and the other billionaires, saying that now is the time we need to take on the teachers' unions once and for all. And to me, that's more threatening to me than what President Hoffa said.
Well, what President Hoffa said wasn't threatening. What President Hoffa said was reality.
Yep.
We have been accused of engaging in a war. Well, in order for there to be a war, people have to fight back. And what President Hoffa suggested on your show was that people fight. I don't see how that is incendiary. I see that as people being patriotic when they heed his call. And he is a great patriot, and his call was for patriotism. And the right-wingers who heard it are engaging in that which they claim under our Constitution should never, ever happen, and that is that they are suggesting that he doesn't have the right to free speech in this country, that free speech only belongs to them, not to us.
Yeah, somehow throwing the bums out at the ballot box is somehow violent.
Somehow that is not merely violent, although violent is bad enough. They're suggesting that speaking out is anti-American and we should be quashed from doing it. And I say to anybody who has the temerity to suggest that in this country where the First Amendment stands for that fundamental proposition that we citizens have a right to speak out against our government, anybody at any place, at any time, Democrat, Republican, left-wing, right-wing, conservative, liberal, progressive, fascist, libertarian, anybody who suggests in any way that that right should be abridged is the one who is being un-American. And what President Hoffa spoke to on your show and in Detroit was speaking to the basic and fundamental nature of what is the fabric that makes this country.
You know, when I look at this whole thing, right now, I there's part of me that thinks had the Republicans not gone after labor so hard, so vehemently, with such vigor, if you will, that, you know, the decline would have continued slowly. But now that you're seeing this all-out frontal attack, it's like being backed into a corner. There's only one way out, and that is fight back. And a large number of the Republican friends that I have who are union members are finally waking up to the fact that their party, and I guess it's only taken them 30 or 40 years to figure it out, their party is the reason that we've seen the union decline in this country and the shrinkage of the middle class.
Well, it's really not their party. It's a fringe of their party who happens to have taken control and hijacked the Republican Party from them that has decided that the way to secure power is to become the handmaiden of multi-billionaire corporate bums who are acting as if the government is there, that our government is their private playground, that we have an obligation to support it, to finance it. We have an obligation to refuse to speak out against it despite its peccadilloes, and that ultimately, in the last analysis, their cash is worth more and more important than our votes. And we need to teach some people some manners here.
I agree. But, you know, here's the thing. I look at this debate, the debate that they had. I got to watch the first hour of it before the program. And I listened to every one of them. Snow White and the other seven dwarfs up there, basically carbon copies of this myth of what Reagan was, all reading off the same script. To me, that is the Republican Party, and they're the ones who want to take us back to the 90s, back to the 1890s.
I think you're absolutely right that this group of presidential pygmies needs to be taught a lesson. I mean, they are playing this for a political play and think that they'll be able to run in October of next year away from their words of September of this year, and we must not let them do so. Romney, the so-called moderate in the group, announced his 50-odd point plan, and I read it in the newspaper today, and one of the major planks in his plan is to weaken unions. Where have we come? This is the party of Nelson Rockefeller. This is indeed the party of George Romney, Mitt Romney's father. And George Romney, of course, was an automotive executive in a heavily unionized industry and in a heavily unionized company. As a matter of fact, the fortune that was used to raise Mitt Romney and send him off to the finest of private schools and set him up as a millionaire long before he reached puberty was money that was earned as a result of the very successful work of a unionized company and the very committed workforce who were all members of the UAW, the IUE, and the Textile Workers Union. It's called American Motors. American Motors, nonetheless.
Yeah. You know, I look at that the whole panel of the eight up there tonight, and I thought back to a Dwight Eisenhower quote. Should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you would not hear of that party again in our political history. He says there is a tiny splinter group, of course, that believes you can do these things. Among them, a few Texas oil millionaires, an occasional politician or businessman from other areas. Their numbers is negligible, and they are stupid. That's 1952. Fast forward to 2011, and that seems to be everything that he said is stupid. It's the platform of the party that he was once the leader of.
May it be said from this day forth, from Dwight Eisenhower's lips to God's ears, may those who advocate these concepts, these programs, these plans, this destruction of America and this elimination of the middle class all get exactly what President and General Eisenhower suggested, that they won't be long for this country.
And that is the hope here. So let me ask you this, Erwin, as the legislature here in Pennsylvania comes back, the attacks, I assume, are going to be coming fast and furious. We've been talking about it. Unemployment compensation, I think, one of the top on the on the list there. What do you see coming right away?
Well, certainly if this summer recess period, so-called recess period, is to be taken for anything, it looks as if unemployment compensation is on the rate again. It wasn't enough to pass back.
Okay, we lost him. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Erwin, appreciate the call, brother. We will get you back next week. You know, with the weather going on, everything is crazy. It is, you know, the little spotty with the cell phone. We're going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show.
Good grief! The genuine populist fury of grassroots Tea Partiers is now being perverted into anti-populism by the very Tea Party Republicans they elected to Congress. Tea Party House members have become the Koch brothers' plutocratic dream. They voted to keep giving a $4 billion a year government subsidy to big oil, to privatize and slash Medicare, to let Wall Street banksters keep ripping off consumers and investors, and to put Social Security on the congressional killing floor. Is this what grassroots voters meant by power to the people? Take Tea Party Congressman Austin Scott. Only you can't. He's already been taken by corporate lobbyists. This Georgia Republican won election last year by waging a full-throated campaign against foreign workers who entered the country illegally. Throw them all out, he ranted. These jobs belong to U.S. citizens. But curiously, Scott did not applaud on July 29th when legal service lawyers won a case to stop a corporation in his district from illegally firing U.S. workers and replacing them with Mexican migrants. Far from applauding, this tough-on-immigrants Tea Party stalwart abruptly shifted sides, favoring the corporation's illegal hiring practices against his own constituents who had been thrown out of their jobs. Indeed, only 3 days after legal services won its case against the corporation, Scott rose up on his hind legs and introduced H.R. 2774, a vindictive one-sentence bill that says, "Be it enacted in Congress assembled that the Legal Services Corporation Act is repealed." This is Jim Hightower saying Scott's hypocrisy is as subtle as a hammer on the head. He professes to be for the people, then tries to kill a program that actually helps poor people pursue justice against corporate elites. Power to the corporations, that's his motto.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So Joe Walsh, the Republican from Illinois, Mr. I don't have the $120,000 to pay my back child support, but I have $35,000 to put into my campaign to run for Congress and not pay my wife that money. Again, Mr. Fiscal Responsibility, Mr. Family Values. You know, I stop and I think about that. You know, how... the party should take him out. This is what they should do. Cleanse themselves of this person. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that you can't allow to happen. This is the stuff that if you're going to be truly the family values people, you take him out and you teach him the what fors. Or as my grandfather always said, a good backhand will make a citizen out of anyone. Maybe a couple of those will help. But, you know, Joe Walsh not going to the president's speech. He's going to be in his home district. And I kind of look at this and I go, it's no wonder he kept losing jobs. He doesn't know where to go. He's supposed to be in Washington starting today, right? That's when the House is supposed to be back, 6:30 today. He's going to be in his home district, not on the job. So I got to wonder, you know, shouldn't the people of his district fire him again? Mr. I owe my kids $120,000. But he's not going to be the only Republican avoiding the speech that President Obama is going to give tomorrow. Diaper Dave is going to be back in Louisiana because he don't want to miss a football game. Can't miss the football game. And I guess, you know, Pampers 2-for-1. Yeah, I'm sure they have a diaper sale right there. So good for him. A number of other Republicans are going to be doing their little teletown halls, I guess, like Georgia Republican Paul Braun. Jim DeMint evidently not going to be there as well. So you're seeing a bunch of these Republicans who are coming out and saying, well, we're going to miss it. We're going to do something else. We're not going to do our job, which is to be sitting in that well, to be sitting there listening to that speech. What this shows me, it shows me that these people have absolutely no respect for the office. You may not like the guy, and I never liked George Bush, but I respected the office. Wasn't a big fan of George H.W. Bush. Wasn't a big fan of Bill Clinton, but you respect the office. And these Republicans respect nothing but their pure ideology. Politico had an interesting little quote, and it's our quote of the day. If Obama has a power problem, Politico writes, It's only because he has to share it with House Republicans, who have shown a suicidal willingness to push the country to the edge in pursuit of political gain and ideological purity. And you look at this and you go, yeah, why are they doing it? The reason they're doing it is they have no idea what to do. There's no jobs plan. There's no there. You look at the big pledge that they came out with. They're going to create jobs. We'll do the job thing. All of the job thing is the same failed policies that got us into the mess that we're in already. More tax cuts, more deregulation, more free trade. Yeah, that's it, man. That's the whole plan. It gets a little worse, and we're going to talk a little bit about Romney in a little bit, but it gets worse. But at the end of it, you and I are the ones who are suffering. And there's a new study out that shows that nearly one in three Americans who grew up in the middle class, those kids who lived that leave it to beaver existence, grew up in a solidly middle class neighborhood, didn't really want for anything because their parents had done, had a good union job, and they lived in a good neighborhood. Well, one in three Americans who grew up in that have now fallen out of the middle class, according to a new report by the Pew Trust, the Charitable Trust. This downward mobility, they're saying, has to do an awful lot with, getting divorced, has an awful lot to do with not getting into college, not being able to pay for it, scoring poorly on standardized tests, and, of course, some with hard drug use. The report says that a middle-class upbringing does not necessarily guarantee the same status over the course of one's lifetime. And it's true. I mean, the reality is it doesn't guarantee you anything, but it gives you the advantage that, people like me didn't have. Where I grew up, you learned a poverty skill set. You learned how to fight. You learned how to scratch and survive. Much different than learning how to do a lot of things that the middle class people have, though, that skill set that they have. Now, fortunately for me, I was able to learn that middle class skill set. Unfortunately, a lot of folks don't. But here, with this slide that they're talking about, people who grew up in the middle class, they don't understand what it's like to live in poverty. And it's difficult to live that existence. And this report kind of goes into that saying, look, we need to get more people who are able to get into college. We need to pay for more of it. You're seeing women who are doing a little bit better in college, but, men are having some problems. So interesting numbers. And it comes back down to jobs. The fact that high school graduates are just falling off the charts into the poverty rolls, to me, says we don't have those jobs that my grandfather's generation had, where you could go into a factory and you could make a reasonable living. And I said at the beginning of the Obama presidency, what I had hoped for this president is that he would be the guy who restores the reward to work. Those low-skill jobs, those back-breaking manual labor jobs that we see the J-1 students taking for $8 an hour, maybe making those livable wage jobs for American workers, maybe in the $12, $13 range like they used to be before we started allowing these companies to exploit all kinds of programs like the J-1 visa program. So anyway, Romney came out with part of his plan. And he wrote an op-ed in the USA Today. Yesterday it was published, and it basically unfurling his job machine. Got to have that job Creighton machine. And he came through with a number of claims. One of them being the marginal income tax rate and tax rates on savings and investment must be kept low, he writes. Further taxes on interest, dividends, and capital gains for middle-class incomes should be eliminated. Here's the thing, and again, they keep pounding at this message, we need lower taxes. Taxes have not been lower in the last 60 years. This is the lowest it's been in 60 years. Lower than the Reagan years, lower than the Bush years, lower than the Clinton years. This is it, man, 60 years, we are at the bottom. And to say that, what we need to do is we need to get rid of capital gains tax, when the reality is almost 70% of all capital gains paid, richest 1%, So you're going to give a massive tax handout to that 1%, while the bottom 95% of us get just about 10%? I mean, again, it's this how you distribute the pie. So you've got this wealth class who, you know, they're gambling on Wall Street, man. They're getting this capital gains. They're sitting on their yachts. They're sitting at their poolside. They're sipping margaritas, having a high old time, letting the dividend checks roll in, paying 15% capital gains, and that's too high for them? While you're out there sweating your backside off, paying 35%? Really? Is that the Romney plan? And somehow, by cutting this capital gains, that's going to affect you and me, the middle class. That's going to affect us. We're going to do so much better when his class of folks don't have to pay that. And he goes on to the next one, which you know is coming, and we're going to eventually see that the corporate tax rate dropped because we've bought in wrongly, but we've bought into the America has the highest corporate tax rate in the world. Oh, we're the highest. And, we're just not competitive. In fact, he writes, our corporate tax rate is among the world's highest. It leaves U.S. firms at a competitive disadvantage and induces them to park their profits abroad, benefiting the rest of the world at our expense. And truth is, we have that 35% corporate tax rate. The problem is we have millions of loopholes. And if you look at the GE model, where they hire numerous tax attorneys to get them out of paying taxes, the reality is we actually pay them to be here. So we have a negative tax rate for some people. Now, you could make an argument that we should be closing those loopholes and making people pay taxes, and I'm all for that. But this idea that somehow, again, we're going to do what the tax reform bill of 86 did, which is lower that rate, close some loopholes temporarily, and then end up lobbying for them in the future while having the lower rate, to me, is just brain dead. It tells me that we haven't learned the lesson. But they think we're stupid. They do. When the reality is we have the second lowest corporate tax rate in the developed world because of all of these loopholes. But they want you to think, oh, it's on paper. Here's the number. Let's lower that down so we can have the lowest tax rate in the world. And you know what they'll say then? It's still not enough. Still not low enough. Understand, it's never going to be enough. We can give them everything. It's not going to be enough. What you have to have here is you have to have demand for business to fill. That simple. Another one of the canards that Romney writes about, he says Obama has vastly expanded the regulatory reach of government. The federal government has estimated the price tag for regulations at $1.7 trillion. And, they pulled this number out of the dark place, reached behind them, and popped it right out. Where most of these numbers come from, especially when you look at the Chamber of Commerce. And in fact, over at EPI, they did a very nice job of debunking the entire thing, saying basically, look, basic conceptual mistakes in this report by the Chamber of Commerce, relies on extraordinarily poor data. The reality is its results should neither be used as a valid measure of the economic cost of regulation nor a guide for policy, according to John Irons. And again, it's this, who do you believe? The right wing is so vested in the Chamber of Commerce. The right wing is so funded by the Chamber of Commerce that doesn't matter what they say. Put out a bunch of bunk and we're going to sell it. Then Romney gets into labor. He goes after the National Labor Relations Board saying, I will not tolerate federal intrusion of the kind that the National Labor Relations Board initiated when it filed suit against Boeing for opening a plant in right-to-work states. Look, and we've gone through this, and if you've listened to the program long enough, this has nothing to do with South Carolina being a right-to-work state. They could have brought those jobs to Pennsylvania, and it still would have been wrong. This is about the fundamental right of workers. Do you have the right to strike or do you not? And in this country, at this moment, right now, we absolutely do. And this is holding a company accountable for breaking the law. It's that simple. And it doesn't get any simpler than that. But they don't want you to look behind the curtain. They don't want you to see what's going on. They want you to just buy the rhetoric. And when Romney talked about his economic plan, this great plan of extending the Bush tax cuts, making sure that his ilk are well funded, making sure that his country club buddies can get a new set of ping golf clubs, make sure that they can hit a new ball every time. When half of all of the money that Bush handed out went to the top 5% of the people in this country. Half. And if we extend them like Romney wants to, you're looking at $4 trillion. Over the next decade, $4 trillion more dollars. He wants to eliminate capital gains taxes. And I already told you that. You know, almost 70% of it go to the top, to that 1%. Wants to go and cut that corporate tax rate. Wants to eliminate the estate tax. Wants to do all the way, all of it, gone. And somehow we're going to have to balance the budget with no money? In fact, what the people over at Think Progress are saying, he's going to add somewhere around $6.5 trillion in debt from 2013 to 2020. If what he has put out is what gets enacted. So all of the slashing, burning, all of the punishing, all of the pain and suffering, not going to amount to a hill of beans. Because we're handing away. Again, you know, when Bush took office, we were looking at paying the debt off. Greenspan was going, I don't know what's going to happen. We have no idea what a debt-free country is going to look like. Well, Bush made sure that that didn't happen. And handed that money out to his country club buddies as well. We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK.
1-888-520. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
With the PSECU Home Equity Line of Credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
My name is Precious, and I help people with mental illnesses live better lives. I work for you, the taxpayers, as a mental health case manager. People with mental illnesses can hold jobs, pay taxes, and provide for themselves. But many of them need help from social workers like me to reach their full potential. Imagine if you or someone you love needed that kind of help and had to go on a waiting list for 7 years. That's what 10 years of budget cuts have already done to mental health caseloads in our state. I know these are tough economic times, but without support services, some individuals get worse and can be a danger to themselves and their communities. And that costs all of us much more in the long run. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they vote to increase funding for programs that help people with mental illnesses lead full lives.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our human services campaign.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. What they do, they smile in your face.
Eight of them on the stage this evening. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs were up there touting their conservative values, telling you how pro-business they're going to be, telling you how they want to destroy Social Security one way or another. But, you know, we're going to save it. You know, we're going to save it for you. You know, we're going to make it work like it used to. We're going to make sure that, you know, we're going to move that retirement age, you know, 4 or 5 years longer than you're going to live. So it's still there for you if you make it. And, of course, we're going to make sure that you can't get health care so that if you get a mild illness, you don't make it through that either. And I think back, and I've been, you know, this whole Labor Day weekend, I've been thinking about my grandfather. And I've been talking about it for a couple of days because it's been on my mind. And because I've been thinking about his life, and I've been thinking about really the generation's life. And I go back to the story he told me about his father, who had passed away from what he called a very curable illness of the day, had they had the money to go to a doctor and get the medical care that they had back then. And, you know, the reality is if they could have kept his father alive, their lives would have been different. You would have had a breadwinner in the house. You wouldn't have, who could have gone out and made their lives better. But instead, you had this guy who died when the kids were young. And you didn't have welfare. You didn't really have any social programs to help folks in those situations. The churches gave out some charity, but not much. Trust me on that. So these folks were on their own, and he would go out, you know, 7, 8 years old, and they 5:30 in the morning, and they would go find coal along the railroad tracks. And he said find in a very sarcastic way, like you jump up on the train and throw it off. That's how you find the coal, so that the house would be warm in the wintertime. Dirt floor, no indoor plumbing, poverty that we can't even really imagine today. And when I look at, you know, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs talking about, well, we need to get rid of all of that stuff. We need to, you know, individual accounts, put that money into Wall Street. Yeah, let's get all that Social Security money into private accounts so that the criminals on Wall Street can do what they did to the housing sector. Steal it all. And I listen to them and all of the things that they're advocating, taking us right back to when my grandfather was a child. You're on your own. And his generation understood that. And you may be tired of me talking about that generation, but, you know, as the people that I spoke to, the kids, as a kid, I was pretty fortunate. My mother worked in a nursing home. And I had the opportunity to talk to people who lived through that. And I had hours to kill, so they were more than happy to tell me about their lives. And the struggles and the pain and the loss. And the separation, and how over the years you saw communities come together. You saw government doing smart things for the people, but by the people. And where I will agree that our government has some problems is we've allowed it to get too far away from us. We've allowed the right wing to message us to death that it's the government. It's those 435 in the House and those 100 in the Senate. It's those people they've done all this. Well, we're the ones who put them there. And you look at the messaging that's gone on, the billionaire class. My grandfather's generation would have never put up with the messaging that's gone on here. When the Koch brothers dug a boatload of cash out of their pocket and started telling you that this guy's a no-good bum, that's the guy they'd vote for. Because the wealth class was for the other guy. Because they understood that, you know what? If the Koch brothers are spending money, they're spending money to benefit themselves. Not you, not society, not your city, your state, your county, not your country. Themselves. And they understood that. We need to understand that. And, you know, we think about the Chamber of Commerce. And it's, you know, the local chamber who plants flowers in the local, you know, gardens and, you know, spruces up, you know, Main Street to make sure the shops look all pretty. And, you know, the local chamber, those people that this isn't the Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber of Commerce are those right-wing terrorists in Washington. The folks who figured out how to grease the tunnel of outsourcing to make sure that every manufacturer in this country has the ability to slide on out of the country with tax credits, with money in their pocket, our money in their pockets. So I look at this report from the folks, and you know, it's almost, you can't make it up. The Cayman Islands website. Evidently, the CEO of the Cayman Islands Chamber of Commerce recently traveled to Los Angeles. He went to the big Chamber of Commerce annual convention, and he got the gold award for Chamber magazines. You know, again, you know, doing the good work of the Chamber of Commerce. And you know what's great about the Cayman Islands? And I love this. The Cayman Islands, they've got like little four-story buildings filled with P.O. boxes where there are 20,000 American companies who have their headquarters there so they can funnel all the profits through, so they can hide all of their profits. We had Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs tonight standing up on that stage in the Reagan Library saying, we need to repatriate all that money from that they've been hiding in the Cayman Islands because they'll put it back to work right here. We've tried that, folks. We've tried the whole repatriation thing. Didn't work. Tried it during the Bush years. And you know what we found? We found what I told you before it happened. You're going to find them buying back the shares of their stock, taking more of their company back. You're going to see them divvying it up amongst themselves because it's a lower rate and they can put it in their pocket. They're not going to create jobs with it. The only thing that creates jobs, folks, demand. That means you having money in your pocket to go to the movies or go to the restaurant or to buy a new car or to buy a washing machine or put a roof on your house, any of that stuff. It's you having money. It's you having the money to spur demand. That's it, period. There's no magic bullet here. It's very simple. If there's a demand, there's someone who's going to meet that demand. Doesn't matter what it is. What corporate America's tried to figure out, and what they've done a masterful job of buying enough politicians to do, is open up the rest of the entire world to be our manufacturer, where we are the consumer of last resort, and they go around the globe, and they exploit labor, they exploit the environment, and now they're saying, oh, well, we want to bring all that money back and all that job-creating cash, if only we could deregulate enough. If only we could pollute the environment enough, if only we could exploit labor enough, if only we could do those things, we could bring those jobs back. It goes back to the Friedman, Thomas Friedman, the great leveling off. When conditions get bad enough here, when wages are low enough, when the environment is exploitable, those jobs will come back here. When we can have air that we have to cut with a knife and water that's a kind of a puke brown, that's when the jobs will come back. That's what they're telling us. If you listen to the Romneys and the Perrys, that's what they're saying. We need deregulation. We need to get all that job-killing regulation. We need to kill the EPA. Is that the country you want to live in? Do you want to live in a place like China? Because that's where they're taking us. That's where they want us to go. Anyway, going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Jeffrey Kidder. He's the author of Urban Flow, Bike Messengers and the City. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back with Jeffrey Kidder. Back after this.
To the Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. As President Obama prepares to address the nation at a joint session of Congress on the jobs crisis, labor is urging the president to rise to the challenge of proposing a solution big enough to deal with the true scope of the jobs crisis. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka at a recent Christian Science Monitor forum said that Obama must act in a big way to help create jobs.
Will he focus on bold solutions on the job crisis, or will he continue to work with the Tea Party to offer cuts to middle-class programs like Social Security, all the while pretending that the deficit is where our economic problems really lie?
Trumka says a CBO report shows that letting the Bush tax cuts expire cuts the deficit in half in 10 years. Putting 14 million Americans back to work would erase the deficit, Trumka says. And Trumka says Obama cannot be a Tea Party president by proposing only what Republicans will accept on the jobs crisis.
If you only propose what you think they'll accept, they control the agenda. I urged him to propose what was necessary to solve the problem, and I hope he does that.
While Obama was in Detroit for Labor Day, UAW President Bob King, Teamsters President James Hoffa, and SEIU President Mary Kay Henry published a newspaper column also calling on the president to create a robust jobs program to put America back to work. The Center for American Progress says that GOP presidential candidate Mitt Romney's jobs plan has a fatal flaw. Not enough action to stimulate demand. Jesse Russell reports.
In advance of President Barack Obama announcing his jobs plan, Republican candidate and former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney unveiled his own. The plan includes 59 proposals that Romney believes will turn around the economy. However, Center for American Progress Economic Policy Vice President Michael Ettlinger said on Tuesday his organization disagrees, as Romney's plan doesn't do enough to address the lack of demand.
The plan is a doubling down on Bush supply-side policies, which not only have been proven failures, but they're clearly addressing the wrong problems in today's economy.
Ettlinger added that small businesses agree the way to turn around the economy is creating demand.
The National Federation of Independent Business survey consistently says that poor sales, which is lack of demand, is the key problem in today's economy, not taxes or regulation. Federal taxes are at the lowest level they've been in more than 60 years.
The president will unveil his jobs plan Thursday during a joint session of Congress.
This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Selling groceries at our hazes. Everything's raisin, but the weight is.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can go there, download our podcast, or get the Stitcher app. If you've got a smartphone, take your program on the go. You know, anyone who's driven in, or I should say driven, that's good. Anyone who's sat in gridlock traffic in places like New York or San Francisco or any big city, you've seen these guys on bikes with, you know, things sticking out of their pouches, zipping in and out of traffic, doing some crazy stuff, and it's kind of annoyed me, in my years of driving. You often wonder where they're going, what they're doing. Well, someone has written a book. His name is Jeffrey Kidder. He's written Urban Flow, Bike Messengers and the City. You can get the book from the link at our site at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Jeffrey Kidder's name. Jeffrey, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Tell me about this book. I mean, why'd you write it?
Well, I was interested in what is it about work or some types of work that can be enjoyable or meaningful for people? Because as we know, a lot of people find their work boring or unsatisfying. But with bike messengers, we see an occupation that, at least for some of them, it really becomes a really essential part of their identity.
Well, it seems to me almost like a thrill seeker type thing. Because I got to be honest with you, riding on a bike in New York traffic to me does not seem like a career path that I'd want to choose.
Well, you're certainly correct that there is a dangerous element, right? I mean, a bicyclist does not have the same sort of protections that would be offered by an automobile, and so when you mix them in with automotive traffic, there is definitely a dangerous element, and messengers are delivering time-sensitive material, things that companies need to be delivered very quickly, and so that increases the risk. So there certainly is a daredevil aspect to it, and really that's part of the reason that the job can be so meaningful for some of the workers, in that that being a bike messenger allows individuals to experience the same sort of excitement and thrills that we usually only find in our leisure time pursuits. You know, we climb mountains, some of us, ride mountain bikes, these sort of things. But with bike messengering, those same sort of excitement can be had for pay.
So at the end of the day, you got home, you didn't get killed. That's an exciting day.
Well, hopefully. You know, I mean, it's not to say that every moment of every day is exciting, but the ability to be out on your own in the city, to be able to basically, as an individual, be creative and make decisions about how you are going to get from point A to point B.
I can see that.
Is something that's really missing from a lot of work, a lot of occupation structure out the ability to have that sort of creativity in your job. And
So,
that's a good day.
Yeah, I drove a truck for years, and I understand that kind of that freedom. You know, I'll chart out my own path. I get that. But I look at this, and I've got to imagine that the injury rates have got to be astronomical. You know, are most bike messengers employees? Are they independent contractors? You know, if someone gets hurt, how does that work?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and unfortunately, the answers aren't that great, I think, from a workers' rights perspective. Depending on the company, depending on the state, depending on the city, some messengers are going to be listed as independent contractors. Whether that's, legal is another issue. And
right.
So a place like New York City, most riders are listed as employees unless they're working completely under the table. But there are a lot of ways that companies can get around having to deal with workers' compensation issues. And so there are a lot of problems, and the injury rate is pretty high, to the extent that no one's really studied it specifically, but it's certainly high.
Yeah, because I got to imagine, you know, zipping around in traffic. I mean, just people opening the door as you're trying to get between cars, that's got to be a danger you've got to be thinking about every day.
Yeah, getting doored is, I mean, not only for bike messengers, basically any cyclist that's riding in an urban area, being doored is a real threat that a lot of non-cyclists don't think about. But the flip side to all this, that even though there is danger and there is a lot of unfairness and inequality in terms of how messengers are covered in terms of workers' comp, in terms of health insurance, those are real problems. But it is also important to think about how the job, unlike other types of low-wage, entry-level work, really does allow the workers to develop a sense of identity and a sense of meaning in their labor, which, again, really is absent in a lot of similar occupations.
Yeah, I had read a little bit about, you know, you talk about these competition, the competition of the job, both on the job and off the job. And I think Alley Cats, is that what it's called? The racing that goes on?
Yes, exactly. So people that are really part of this the occupation really become part of a whole subculture that takes sort of defines not only their work lives but also their lives in total, as well as their leisure time. In fact, in many cases, being a bike messenger is more about what you're doing when you're not at work, and a big part of this is taking part in these open events in open traffic called Alley Cats, where messengers, both locally as well as traveling around the country and the world, go to meet other messengers and race against them in these events called Alley Cats, which are basically replicating the workday, except it's for free. And again, thinking about labor, how many people want to do for free the things that they're usually paid for? So that does speak to how the job can be enjoyable.
Yeah, I can imagine that, and you know the competition that would go. I'm the best bike bike messenger in the country. My only view into that industry is that movie with Kevin Bacon a number of years back. I think it was called Quicksilver. If that was it, that's it. That's that, and sitting in traffic, going, I hate that guy for being able to get through traffic, and I have to sit here.
Yeah, no, that's true. Quicksilver is a classic movie. It's not really very good, but I think most bike messengers have at least watched it for the kitsch value. What you just said about being stuck in a car and feeling a little bit of resentment about the cyclist being able to whiz through, that really gets at why that job is so enjoyable, is that because of the way city transportation has been structured, the bicycle, by being neither pedestrian nor automobile, the bicyclist is able to sort of utilize that sort of fact that they don't really fit in anywhere. They don't really belong on a sidewalk. The roads weren't really designed for them, and they're able to sort of creatively manipulate their way through traffic, and that is a major part of how they're able to find joy and excitement, as well as how they're able to offer such quick deliveries for company.
Yeah, and they're on a short time frame. Let me ask you about the bikes. I mean, you know, I think of a bike. I got a bike, and it's got two wheels and a couple of pedals. Anything special about a messenger's bike?
Yeah, I mean, messengers, at least in New York and some other places since the early 80s, have been riding track bikes. And so track bikes were developed originally for events on a velodrome, which is basically a oval track with bank corners. Most of your listeners, if they've ever seen track racing, it probably would be during the Summer Olympics. Other than that, it's sort of an obscure cycle sport. But a track bike doesn't have brakes. It doesn't coast. If the pedals are moving, the rear wheel's moving, so the way you stop a track bike is sort of by forcing the pedals to stop moving,
right,
which is different than the coaster brakes on a kid's bike. It's a unique skill set. And so starting in the early 80s, New York messengers started using these style of bikes in order to make their deliveries, because there's less to break, there's less to steal on them.
Less to steal.
Yeah, well, New York, you know.
New York, absolutely.
Major problem, especially in the 80s. And now, I mean, today, fixed-gear bikes or track bikes are pretty trendy. You can find them pretty much anywhere. But throughout the 80s and 90s, if you were riding a track bike on city streets, you were probably a messenger or you knew a messenger. It was a unique sort of status symbol to be able to ride a track bike in urban traffic. But now it's sort of taken on its own sort of trend.
Do you have, like messenger groupies? Do you have people who are trying to break into the industry? All that underculture, do you have any all of that?
There definitely is sort of, I mean, bicycles have sort of had a resurgence in terms of them being sort of like a hip sort of fashion accessory. And so in many ways, this sort of new bicycle chic that exists among the 20-something sort of college crowd is definitely in some ways modeled after many of the sort of styles and as well as the riding styles that messengers made famous with movies like Quicksilver in the 80s.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Jeffrey Kidder. He's the author of Urban Flow, Bike Messengers and the City. During the break, the third caller is going to get a copy of Urban Flow. Just give our producer here a call, and we'll get it out to you. And looking at this job, you think about, you know, a job that you're going to need to feed your family with, wages, hours, conditions. Conditions got to be horrible, traffic, weather, because you do this all year round, correct?
Yeah, I mean, rain, sleet, or snow.
Like the post office, only faster.
Yeah, exactly.
So the hours, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, conceivably?
Yeah, I mean, in places like New York, you do have companies that offer sort of odd-hour deliveries, but in general, messengers are going to be doing most of their work during normal business hours. This is when various companies like advertising firms or law firms are most in need of, like, documents that need signatures or hard copy proofs of things. So there's probably some messenger out there somewhere who's pedaling away at 2 in the morning. But by and large, it's a sort of maybe we could say 8 to 7 sort of time frame.
So wages, what's an average bike messenger make?
It really does vary from city to city. It also varies, most importantly, by what company you work for in cities. Different companies offer very different pay structures. In general, it's better to work, in terms of actual dollars in, it's better to work for a smaller company. They usually pay, most messengers are paid a commission, and so smaller companies usually will give a rider around 60% of the delivery charge, whereas the big sort of corporate companies, you're maybe only making 40 or 45% on what the total cost of the delivery was. So if you average it all out, messengers are probably making about $5 per delivery. But some runs are going to be worth a lot, whereas other runs are going to be worth very little. But it probably averages out to about $5 a delivery.
So is there much unionization in this? Is it possible? I read in your book, you know, I guess about 10 years ago, the Teamsters tried to organize some of the messengers in New York, you know, saying basically you sweatshop on wheels, much like the trucking industry today. Anything like that?
I mean, yeah, as you mentioned, in the 90s, there was some effort in New York, and it fell pretty flat. On the West Coast, messengers have maybe been a little bit more successful with some sort of looser types of organizing, but it's an industry that does not lend itself to organizing, largely because each individual rider realizes that there's a certain incentive, right, to not to not be part of the collective effort and instead scoop up all the work if people were to sort of have a slowdown or a sit out. So in terms of traditional labor organizing, bike messengers do not fit the mold, and that's unfortunate from a certain perspective. But again, what I try to focus on in the book is more about how the job offers enjoyments and offers satisfaction that is very different and very unique from issues about equitable pay. And of course, equitable pay is an essential part of workers' rights, but also having a job that's enjoyable, a job that's fulfilling is important too. And so messengering sort of meets the criteria of the latter quite well, but the former not so much.
Yeah, this isn't necessarily a job you're gonna do 20 or 30 years, is it?
There are people that have, but it takes a huge toll on the body, and the risks are very high. So it's by and large a job done by men in their early 20s, for sure.
In your experience, what's the strangest thing you ever delivered?
I delivered family photos for Kathleen Turner, which was odd, and I also delivered a sample of blood to the Red Cross.
Oh, I was expecting a leg or something, but okay. Last question I've got, the book Urban Flow, Bike Messengers and the City, written by Jeffrey Kidder. Again, there's a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Jeffrey's name. It'll take you right there. And again, we're going to give this away during the break, third caller. So what kind of response have you gotten from the people who are in the industry to your book?
I think that many of them are pretty excited. There's some photos in there. So I've had, several people, I think, that are very excited to sort of show their parents, like, hey, look, here's my photo.
Hey, here I am. Yeah. That's a good thing. Jeffrey Kidder, I appreciate the time. Good book, and keep up the work.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, again, the book Urban Flow, Jeffrey Kidder, the author. We got a link at thericksmithshow.com, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Third caller, it's yours. Back after this.
Provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
Good grief! The genuine populist fury of grassroots Tea Partiers is now being perverted into anti-populism by the very Tea Party Republicans they elected to Congress. Tea Party House members have become the Koch brothers' plutocratic dream. They voted to keep giving a $4 billion a year government subsidy to big oil, to privatize and slash Medicare, to let Wall Street banksters keep ripping off consumers and investors, and to put Social Security on the congressional killing floor. Is this what grassroots voters meant by power to the people? Take Tea Party Congressman Austin Scott. Only you can't. He's already been taken by corporate lobbyists. This Georgia Republican won election last year by waging a full-throated campaign against foreign workers who enter the country illegally. Throw them all out, he ranted. These jobs belong to U.S. citizens. But curiously, Scott did not applaud on July 29th when legal service lawyers won a case to stop a corporation in his district from illegally firing U.S. workers and replacing them with Mexican migrants. Far from applauding, this tough-on-immigrants Tea Party stalwart abruptly shifted sides, favoring the corporation's illegal hiring practices against his own constituents who had been thrown out of their jobs. Indeed, only 3 days after legal services won its case against the corporation, Scott rose up on his hind legs and introduced H.R. 2774, a vindictive one-sentence bill that says, "Be it enacted in Congress assembled that the Legal Services Corporation Act is repealed." This is Jim Hightower saying Scott's hypocrisy is as subtle as a hammer on the head. He professes to be for the people, then tries to kill a program that actually helps poor people pursue justice against corporate elites. Power to the corporations, that's his motto.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, Visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
So this is where the country is going. And I almost cannot believe that it's happening in this country right now. Politico reported 3 people were arrested and 20 people were removed from Representative Paul Ryan's appearance at his pay-per-view town hall meeting on Tuesday. He had a pay-per-view town hall meeting. Let that sink in for a second. We pay him $174,000 a year plus benefits, plus, you know, a pension, plus all of that. We already pay him for his time. And yet we've got to pay him more in order to see him and to talk to our representative. Can anyone think of a reason why this is a bad idea? And when I first read this, I'm going, well, you know, I'm not surprised. Lou Barletta up the road here, the Republican up near Hazleton, he's one of them. Had a pay-per-view, no free ones. Renee Elmers, Republican from North Carolina, same thing. Ben Quayle, Republican from Arizona, same thing. All pay-per-views, no free town hall events. And I look at this and I go, what happened to Of, For, and By We the People? Our representatives. And, you know, if the Democrats would have done this ever, not only would I be complaining, not only would I be screaming, but every Republican on this planet, every right-wing hack with a microphone would be railing against, look at the Democrats, they're charging their constituents. How dare they? Well, how dare these Republicans do this? And there's part of me that goes, you know what? This is the Republican vision of how the country is going to operate in the future. Everything is pay for play. There is nothing that is part of the commons. There is nothing that is ours. There's nothing that belongs to we the people. Everything has a profit motive. There's nothing that we do just for the common good. Nothing. Everything has to be done for profit. Everything has a market. Everything has a price. Everything has a profit motive. Everything. You want to meet with your congressman? $100. But I thought we already paid his salary. Nope, that's just above and beyond. But what it's telling me that the Republicans are looking at the rest of us like they've been looking at the Koch brothers and the billionaire class. You want something from me? It's going to cost you. Your lobbyist wants a piece of my ear? It's going to cost you. Money in the till. So these 3 people were arrested, 20 kicked out. They paid. They paid to get in. Paid the $15. Asked a question. No, where are the jobs? You know, what's going on here? You ran on this. And he had the audacity, had the temerity to say, I'm going to keep on talking because this is what you asked me to come here to do. No, they can't. They asked you to come here so they can have a conversation with you. Talking is just speaking. Having a conversation is both talking and listening. And he goes on to say, I've never been so encouraged before. Yeah, because the police are taking your constituents out of the meeting. And he said, there are going to be protests. Going to happen. We're going to have this for a while. So these 3 people were arrested. 2 of them were cited Two of them were cited for trespassing and fined $429. The third person was cited for trespassing and resisting arrest, fined $681. Just outrageous. And yet we somehow willing to put up with it. Amazing stuff. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. Got Stosh on line one. How you doing tonight, Stosh?
All right, Rick. How you doing?
I'm angry. I'm ticked off. I'm frustrated. I'm PO'd, man. When a representative says, you've got to pay me to come and have your voice heard, to me, that's criminal.
I know what you mean. Now, I just have one question.
Hit me.
You always talk about these Koch brothers. You know, I'm new to your show. I don't have a clue who these people are. Can you give me some...
Charles and David Koch. They are two of the wealthiest people in this country. They own Koch Industries. They do natural gas and oil extraction, some paper stuff. They own a lot of industries throughout the Midwest, Kansas, Wisconsin. Billionaires. And they have been billionaires since their father was a billionaire. They're old money. They're big money. They fund everything under the sun. Americans for Prosperity, Freedom Works, they fund it all. When you want a professor on the board of economics at Florida State University, you've got to beg them to put that professor on, and he'd better be a free market ideologue or he's not going to be able to teach there. If you want to go to any of these universities across the country, he's probably bought their economics department. This guy, these people are extremely wealthy, extremely powerful. And look, they're right-wing ideologues that want to destroy this country, take us back to the 90s, the 1890s. But those are the Koch brothers. They're the ones who fund a lot of the attacks. They're the ones who fund a lot of these right-wing think tanks. They're the ones who fund the messaging that goes into telling folks like you and me that, well, you don't need unions. You need the free market. You don't need community. You don't need government. You need to be a rugged individual. That's the crap that they spew.
Where are they based out of?
They're out of Kansas. I think the Koch brothers are, I think they live in Kansas.
Oh, wow.
But they're a couple of the most, the two of them, and really the whole billionaire class. I mean, you can go through Richard Mellon Scaife, you can go through the Coors family, the Mars family, the Walmart family, you can, the Olin family, Foundation, you can go through all of these families who have accumulated wealth and massive mountains of wealth. Wealth beyond what you and I can comprehend, really. I mean, they are wealthier than we can imagine for the most part. This is what the founders were afraid of. This is what the founders were afraid of, this mass accumulation of wealth that makes them more powerful than government, more powerful than we the people. And they're exercising their strength. They have these little meetings every year where they decide how they're going to divvy up the country and how they're going to take this country back for them. In fact, you know, the last meeting they had, they called President Obama Saddam Hussein and said, this is the war of the mother of all wars.
Well, I guess that's something to tell. I didn't know.
That's why we're here.
I appreciate it, Rick.
Thank you, Stosh. Great talking to you, brother.
All right.
But, you know, look, you know, all these billionaires, we've given them this money. Stop and think about it. Go back to the Eisenhower years. The top marginal tax rate on someone like the Koch brothers would be 92%. We as a society said, you know what, we don't want to have a moneyed elite. We don't want to have the land of gentry. We don't want to have overlords. We want to have a massive middle class. We want to have wealth distributed across the seas, across the plains. Everybody who's willing to work and get their hands dirty or ache their back, they're going to make a good living, and their kids are going to have opportunity. But since the 1940s, 50s, 60s, what we've seen is this attack on the middle class in favor of the wealth class. Kennedy started it, said, oh, well, you know, we need to lower that rate and close the loopholes. So we lowered the rate, closed the loophole from 92 to 70%. Closed some loopholes, rich people started paying a little bit more taxes. Then they said, oh, gee, you know, we got our tax loopholes back. Reagan comes in, oh, let's drop it from 70 down to 50. So we did that. Then we dropped it down to 25, 28%. And Bush lost his election by going, oh, gee, you know, we're going to go broke. I better raise taxes. So no more read my lips. I got to do what's right for the country. Cost him the election. Clinton raised taxes up to 39%. Bush dropped it back down to 35. And look where we are. You know, during the Eisenhower years, we built the interstate system. a massive undertaking. Huge amounts of public dollars went into this. We couldn't do that today. We don't have the funding. It's maddening what we've allowed to happen in this country. Anyway, going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miners' pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the anti-immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strike breakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours, in a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in labor's forgotten massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.ricksmithshow.com.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. The words from George Orwell from one of my favorite books, 1984. He who controls the present controls the past. He who controls the past controls the future. Those are the words written in the opening of Paul Cole, his latest piece, American Labor in U.S. History Textbooks, How Labor's Story is Distorted in High School History Textbooks. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. An interesting piece. Distorted? I don't know. Non-existent? That was my experience. Anyway, let's talk to Paul Cole, founder and director of the American Labor Studies Center. Paul, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, great to be with you tonight.
You know, I look at this and you say that the history has been distorted. It was my experience. It was never taught.
Well, I think it's some of both. I taught high school social studies, actually a course in American Labor Studies back from about 1961 to 1983, not to give my age away. And there was very little in the curriculum and very little in the textbooks. And what was there most often just focused on conflict and strikes and so on.
Molly Maguire, that's all I remember.
Yeah, and that's probably a good example of what was there. I must say the textbooks that we reviewed are better, but having said that, I think our assessment here that they're still spotty, inadequate, and slanted, and holds up under our investigation. We took four textbooks, which are the major high school American history textbooks that are used, at least the industry says, by over 80% of the kids in the country, and did a systematic evaluation of them, and that's where our conclusions are drawn from.
You know, when I look at this, and there's so much that what we hear in the mainstream media right now being told about unions that really is just so not true. That this whole view, and I talk to people every day about this, the view of labor is that it's something that, well, organized labor, that was something we needed way back then when times were bad. And the reality is we still have 50,000 people a year who die of occupational illnesses. We still have millions of people who are injured on the job. We still have wage theft that's rampant. I'm not quite sure where this mentality that it's something we needed in the past. I look at the conditions now and say it's something we need right now.
Well, we need it as much as we've ever needed it. And if you look at the polling, 50 million Americans said they would join a union if they had a real opportunity to do so. But we know the opposition of major corporations and all the tactics they employ have made it extremely difficult, if not impossible, at least in the private sector, for workers in many cases, especially small companies, to organize.
You know, we went to Wisconsin during the height of the uprising there back in February, and a number of the young college students that I had an opportunity to talk to, for them, what sparked that thing for them was the fact that Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, said that he was going to call in the National Guard. And in Wisconsin, they have mandatory labor education in the school, something that they passed a couple of years back. And these kids remembered that and hearkened back to some of their education, saying the governor's going to call out the National Guard. This can't bode well for us.
That's right. Historically, the role of the government has come down on the side of the employers who had all the influence with the government, and they could call in the National Guard or federal troops or whatever, or private groups like the Pinkertons to aid the employers in busting the unions and, doing everything they can to make sure that the workers were not successful in organizing.
So what are the things that we should be talking about? I mean, the reality is and what I try and talk about here on the program is not just the organization that unions did in the workplace to make sure that we had better wages, hours, and conditions, but also the broad societal advancements, things like Social Security, things like unemployment compensation. The list goes on, OSHA, you name it. There's a whole bunch of things that we take for granted that we didn't know how it came to be.
Well, that's right. I mean, the problem is most of the media focuses on the collective bargaining process and where it's not going well, and that makes news. And the same thing is true of the textbooks. Our argument here is that is a distortion, but also it leaves out all the contributions of the labor movement. You may have seen that great bumper sticker. It says, "The labor movement, the people who brought you the weekend."
Sure.
And what we're talking about here is the vital role of organized labor in advocating for broad social protections, as you mentioned, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, occupational safety and health, environmental protection. There's nothing in there that really talks about the role of organized labor played in the civil rights movement, the strong support in the Great March on Washington, where Martin Luther King gave a speech, was actually a march for jobs as well, with Walter Reuther and the AFL-CIO and other groups strongly supportive of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. In fact, when Lyndon Johnson signed that bill, he turned and handed the first pen to George Meany. So there's that long and continuing support for civil rights. The whole rise of the public sector unionism that brought generations of Americans into the middle class and new rights to public employees. And the other thing that's never talked about is the role of the labor movement international affairs in the fight for helping workers, form free and independent unions, whether it's in Chile or in Poland or in South Africa or other places, or the work that they did in making sure that Europe was free and democratic following World War II. There's just so much out there that is neglected and not incorporated in any of the in the curriculum. I don't blame the teachers here, because the teachers understand and never had this in their elementary, secondary, post-secondary, or graduate education. It's not there. It certainly hasn't found itself into most of the social studies standards or in, as we see, into the textbooks. Although, as I said, the textbooks are better now. You will find more treatment than what you've had in the past. But still, this exclusive focusing on conflict arising out of the collective bargaining process excludes all of the other kinds of major contributions that the American labor movement, more broadly speaking, have made to our country.
You know, and hammering on that, you know, I look at what went on down in Texas over the last year and a half or so, where they were trying to rewrite the Texas history books, putting in people like Phyllis Schlafly and taking out folks like Thomas Jefferson. This fight
and
over
Cesar Chavez.
Exactly. This fight over what our children are exposed to. The right, I think, has done a masterful job of organizing the masses to go and push for this real bizarre rewrite of our history.
Well, it's nothing new. You know, there was a book written a couple decades ago by Elizabeth Fones Wolfe calling Selling the Free Enterprise, Business Assault on Labor and Liberalism. It really talks about the period from 1945 to 1960. And there's chapter and verse there of how American corporations and the National Association of Manufacturers and others had major campaigns because they saw the labor movement come out of the 30s and the 40s very strong, and this concept of economic and social justice, and they mounted a major campaign in the media, but also in the schools to indoctrinate and inculcate unfettered free enterprise and individualism. You see those words a lot now, and individualism really is a code word that says that you don't really need unions or anybody else. You either rise or fall on your own.
I can make my own deal.
That's right.
I hear that all the time, and I go, well, you know, that's okay if you make your own bad deal, but it affects me. When it affects me, then I have a problem.
That's right.
So let me ask you this, you know, as you were looking at these textbooks, how much of the employer abuses were covered? I mean, you look at, you look at Latimer, you look at Ludlow, you look at a lot of these coal strikes where the coal barons were hiring thugs to come in and you know, burn people out or shoot them and do all this stuff. How much of that is covered in these books or not at all?
Well, it's misrepresented, and what it looks like is when you see all of those kinds of things, when they talk about things like labor unrest and things of that nature, they're trying to paint the color that here that it's all the labor and these wild-eyed, fanatic labor union people who are creating all these problems. Without what they fail to do in virtually every case is look at what the rationale and what the causes and what the working conditions were that these people were protesting and what they were trying to overcome, as well as the the response on the part of corporate Americans. So you've got Carnegie and Rockefeller and all these other people who were great philanthropists, and everybody said, oh, isn't that wonderful, spending the money they earned on the backs of people that they exploited. So that, it's a bias. It's a very strong bias in favor of corporation when you look at labor-management relations as it's treated throughout the history of the United States in virtually every textbook.
Yeah, and what we're living, I mean, to highlight what you've just said, we're living that right now. Here in the area, Hershey, Pennsylvania is just down the road from where we're at here in Harrisburg. And, you know, Milton Hershey is looked on as this great philanthropist, this benevolent, well, I call him benevolent dictator, but, you know, this benevolent figure who, you know, was this philanthropist and all of this. But, you know, you got Hershey Corporation now abusing these J-1 visa students who came over here for a cultural exchange program working in their warehouse and on their factory line. You kind of look at this and go, same scenario.
Well, that's exactly right. And you have these people who make all this money create these big foundations. I mean, Walmart's a classic example of that. And they have billions of dollars in foundations, and they do all wonderful things. And it's all part of the major public relations program to portray them as very positive in the image of the public so that people will do business there. Well, in the meantime, they don't really talk about, you know, how they lock workers in at night or they don't pay them for hours that they work and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a shame.
Yeah, the PR game is an excellent example. I remember during Hurricane Katrina, and I had read this, that Walmart sent $8 million worth of water down to the folks in who were suffering down there, but they spent $18 million advertising the fact that they sent this water down there.
Yeah, the other thing, you know, we're coming upon the 10th anniversary of 9/11. you will probably will not see anywhere in the press that every single worker who responded to that, the policemen, the firemen, the EMT, the construction workers, all of the service workers who are involved in responding, all the respondents, all the first responders and second responders, virtually in 100% of the cases, 9/11 were union members.
Yep.
And you're not going to hear that at all. The same thing has happened when the U.S. airplane went down in the Hudson River. Everybody who was involved in the rescue of that, including the people on the plane, the pilots and the flight attendants, and the EMT people and everybody else, the fire people, all union members. And I'll bet you a dollar to a donut you don't hear anything during this 9/11 that these wonderful firefighters who lost their lives and the policemen and everybody else, that they were organized.
I'll bet you're absolutely right. In fact, and you know, Sully Sullenberger, the pilot of that plane that went down in the Hudson, he was the hero. He was everywhere until he went to Congress and said, I wouldn't have my kids become pilots because you've allowed the wages to be cut and slashed and all these mergers and my pension's gone. He said he wouldn't let his own kids do it.
Well, and he's a good union member and training director for, you know, the ALPA,
Airline Pilots Association. Right. Let me ask you this last question I've got before we wrap this up. You know, how do we change this? How do we take back the message? I've been, you know, saying for the longest time, labor needs to get out and tell their story because somebody's telling it just from a negative perspective.
Well, it's interesting. A polling by the AFL-CIO a while back said for the first time in American history, a majority of Americans, 54%, said they knew little or nothing of the labor movement. About the labor movement, and where they learned it was in the paper or they talked to people. The interesting thing about that poll is they never even asked the question whether they learned anything in school or not. And then the more recent poll shows, you know, the popularity of labor is down.
Yep.
And so if you look at, we can't do cross tabs because they're two different polls, but I think it's safe to say that the people who are not supportive of labor are the people who don't know anything about labor. Because if you know something about labor and what they do and what their mission is and what their goals and objectives are, not only for their members, but in a sense the people's lobby for all workers and for all middle class in terms of the legislation they support, I think that whole attitude would turn around. But look, you've got ideologues here now on the right who are unfettered free marketers, and they think that there should be no minimum wage, no unemployment insurance, no Social Security, and certainly no unions because the market is pure and it works that way. So that's the ideology that we're confronting as we see this campaign unfold this year.
They want to take us back to the 90s.
They want to take us back to the 1920s is what they want to do.
Well, they want to take us back to the 90s, the 1890s.
Yeah, that's right.
I've been saying they've been trying to repeal the entire 20th century. And you look at Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs tonight doing the debate.
Yeah.
I don't know how you could differ with that conclusion.
Yeah, well, look, we came out of the Gilded Age and we had the Progressive Era. And we came out of the 1920s and we had the 1930s. So maybe we'll come out of the early part of this century, and we'll have a rebirth. I mean, that's what you saw in Wisconsin and Ohio. In other words, is what they've done is they've motivated workers here to get a lot more active and a lot more concerned about what's going on to them as individuals and to the labor movement in general.
I think you're absolutely right. Paul Cole, I appreciate the time. Founder and director of the American Labor Studies Center, their piece, American Labor in U.S. History Textbooks, How Labor's Story is Distorted in High School Textbooks. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Paul Cole's name. It'll take you right there. Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is why we fight, why we lie away. This is why, this is why we fight.
Finally, radio for the rest of us. Rick Smith.
Ask me, Council 13 members. Did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, they had their moment on the stage at the Reagan Library. You know, they're out there slashing and trying to outgut each other and outpunish each other. You know, you got to make sure that we punish those working people. My favorite line of the entire, the entire presentation, because evidently it's not a debate, is they ask Gingrich about the individual mandate, of which I think has to be there. I think you have to mandate that everybody's in the game for it to work. It's what they're talking about taxes. Everyone has to have a skin in the game for taxes. But for making sure that you're covering yourself with health insurance, no, we can't have that. No. But Gingrich, because Gingrich is one of the guys who back in the 90s proposed the individual mandate. And the person asking the question knew that. So everybody else is saying, no individual mandate. No. Because that's the Republican way now. But Gingrich, he's stuck with it. He said, yes, we need to have an individual mandate. Everybody's got to be in. So he did the best job I think I've ever seen of anybody ever deflecting a question. He went on for his whole time, never coming anywhere near the question. He said, I'm not interested in you getting Republicans to fight each other. And he turned the whole question back on the guy asking the question, the guy from Politico, I think his name's Harris, saying, well, you're not gonna turn us against each other, we're not gonna fight each other, and we're not gonna stand here and beat each other up. And I'm sitting here going, well, is this not a debate? Is that not what you do in a debate? You flesh out your opinions and contrast them against everybody else? Isn't that the point? Evidently not. So pretty interesting responses there. Healthcare, everybody's against Obamacare. Everybody was against Obama from, you know, that seems to be the carbon copy thing. Bachman, it was Obamacare. You know, one of my favorite moments also, Herman Cain with his 999 plan. He's gonna lower corporate taxes down to 9%. He's gonna lower personal taxes down to 9%. And he's gonna raise sales tax up to 9%. So again, stop and think about this, folks. You want to talk about a massive redistribution of wealth? Right here with this 9% sales tax that he's talking about. And here's the other part of this. It's not going to be enough to cover our bills. So it's going to mean more slashing, more cutting, more gutting, and more punishing of the poor and the elderly. So, you know, hey, good policy. The other part I liked, Ron Paul sticking to his guns. Privatize everything. The market takes care of it all. All of it. It's all wonderful. Which means we need to privatize everything. Just privatize it all. Because, you know, the free market will take care of it. And I look at Ohio. Last week I didn't get to talk about this, but Ohio is privatizing one of their prisons, the Lake Erie Correctional Institute. It's an 11-year-old prison that they built. It houses about 1,500 low-security, nonviolent prisoners. I mean, it's a pretty mild prison. I mean, you're not your maximum security, not your tough criminals. They're selling it. And again, you know, you kind of go, okay, let's think about this. They're going to sell it to the Corrections Corporation of America for $72.7 million. $72.7 million. Stop and think about it. Let's do a little bit of math. Because according to the spokesperson for the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections, Carlo Loparo, they said that this Corrections Corporation of America was going to be paid a per diem of $44.25 per day for each inmate. A little quick math, it works out to about $66,000 a day, works out to $24,226,875 per year. Now, you're talking about the $72.7 million that the state of Ohio is going to get for this. This company is going to make back in about 3.5 years, a little less than 3.5 years. They're going to get all their money back that they paid to the state, and then it's pure profit from then on, baby. Over the next decade, the next 10 years, you're looking at $224 million the taxpayers in the state of Ohio are going to fork over to this Corrections Corporation of America. And guess what Corrections Corporation for America is going to go back and do again, which they've been doing for the last, well, at least the last decade, the last 2 decades, since the mid-90s with the three strikes and you're out nonsense. They're going to be pushing for strict mandatory sentencing, sentencing guidelines to make sure there's prison involved. Why? Duh. They got to make their $72.7 million back. You got to love privatization. You got to love what was once ours, we the people's, now in the hands of private for-profit interests. So now the prison industrial complex, another feather in their cap. They're going to put up a little bit of money right now, and we are going to pay them. We're going to pay them for the privilege of them running our prisons. Doesn't that worry you? For me, it scares the hell out of me. Because prison is not a growth industry. It shouldn't be a profit-driven industry, but it's going to be. The more we privatize, the more we put what was our responsibility in the hands of these profiteers, these people who are putting up venture capital, do you think they're going to put that money up if they're going to lose because they're patriotic Americans and they care about the safety of the nation? Hell no. They're in it to make money, and a lot of money. And you know what I find amazing? How well the wealth class has convinced you and me that we need to have these big prisons and these big police departments and all of this law enforcement, the cameras and everything to protect them from us. You gotta love it, man. Dum da dum dum. Gonna take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. Your thoughts after this. Stick around. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. As President Obama prepares to address the nation at a joint session of Congress on the jobs crisis, labor is urging the president to rise to the challenge of proposing a solution big enough to deal with the true scope of the jobs crisis. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka, at a recent Christian Science Monitor forum, said that Obama must act in a big way to help create jobs.
Will he focus on bold solutions on the job crisis, or will he continue to work with the Tea Party to offer cuts to middle-class programs like Social Security, all the while pretending that the deficit is where our economic problems really lie?
Trumka says a CBO report shows that letting the Bush tax cuts expire cuts the deficit in half in 10 years. Putting 14 million Americans back to work would erase the deficit, Trumka says. And Trumka says Obama cannot be a Tea Party president by proposing only what Republicans will accept on the jobs crisis.
If you only propose what you think they'll accept, they control the agenda. I urged him to propose what was necessary to solve the problem, and I hope he does that.
While Obama was in Detroit for Labor Day, UAW President Bob King, Teamsters President James Hoffa, and SEIU President Mary Kay Henry published a newspaper column also calling on the president to create a robust jobs program to put America back to work. The Center for American Progress says that GOP presidential candidate Mitt Romney's jobs plan has a fatal flaw, not enough action to stimulate demand. Jesse Russell reports.
In advance of President Barack Obama announcing his jobs plan, Republican candidate and former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney unveiled his own. The plan includes 59 proposals that Romney believes will turn around the economy. However, Center for American Progress Economic Policy Vice President Michael Ettlinger said on Tuesday his organization disagrees, as Romney's plan doesn't do enough to address the lack of demand.
The plan is a doubling down on Bush supply-side policies, which not only have been proven failures, but they're clearly addressing the wrong problems in today's economy.
Ettlinger added that small businesses agree the way to turn around the economy is creating demand.
The National Federation of Independent Business survey consistently says that poor sales, which is lack of demand, is the key problem in today's economy, not taxes or regulation. Federal taxes are at the lowest level they've been in more than 60 years.
The president will unveil his jobs plan Thursday during a joint session of Congress.
This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is cancer. This isn't a sudden crisis that's going to erupt out of the ground like some monster trying to eat us. This is a slow, wasting process.
I kept the promise till the vow got broke. I had to drink from the laughing cup, stood on the banks till the river rose up. I saw the bride in a ring, yeah. I was in the house when the house burned down.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-RICK. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. You know, going back to this, and you think about the money that we hand over to for-profit corporations by this whole privatization scheme, whether it's the, you know, our parking garages, our turnpikes, our transportation, whatever it is. Do you really think that the for-profit interests are going to get into it? That these venture capitalists who can put their money virtually anywhere, do you think they're going to invest in our infrastructure, in our institutions? If there's no back end for them, if there's no way to line their pockets and fill the coffers, do you really think that they're going to do it out of the goodness of their hearts because they care about society? Do you really think that? No, they're going to do it because they can make tons of money. And there's no other better investment out there. Prisons, great investment, especially if you can get them cheap. $72 million may sound like a lot of money. Sorry, for a prison, not very much. In fact, Ohio had hoped to sell 5 of its prisons. Now, all they wanted was $200 million. But the venture capitalists said, no, just this one. This one is worth it because we can make our money back in under 3.5 years. Think about that. So from now until the end of time, for those 1,500 people who will be in that prison, and trust me, they will bump that up to 1,600 or 1,700, because you know the overcrowding and, you know, the for-profit corporation, they're not going to have to worry about those pesky inspectors. After all, it's private property. And the $44.25 per inmate, I can guarantee you that's going to go up over the next several years, because where else are you going to put your prisoners? You going to transport them out of state? Not likely. But again, you go back to the $66,375 every single day for those 1,500 inmates. Over $24 million a year, $242 million over the next decade. That's what they're going to put in their pockets. That's the money that they're going to make. And education is next. And we're going to hear it. The voucher schemes are coming up. This whole idea of privatization. You know, everywhere I look, there are forces trying to destroy public education. I took my kids over to the Harrisburg Senators game over the weekend. Because, you know, we love going to the games, and it's exciting now, especially since they're in the playoffs and all that. So the kids loved going. Everywhere I looked, PA Cyber, K12.com. I'm seeing all this money being used to convince us that we need to go away from public education. Oh, your child needs individual attention that you can only get with PA Cyber. So let me get this straight. I'm going to put my kid in front of a computer all day long? Is that what you're telling me? Well, yes. And they're going to have that interaction thing with other kids? Not so much. And who's paying for this? Oh, yeah, we are. We're paying for the destruction of public education. And I know. Save me the BS. PA Cyber is a public school. Yeah, okay. I get that. But what we're paying to destroy the brick and mortar. And that plays right into the hands of the profiteers. That plays right into the hands of the people who are looking at education as the next area of investment. Because we don't make anything here anymore. Our trade policies have screwed that all up. And the corporate citizens, you know, the patriotic corporate Americans, because after all, corporations are people now. I wonder if they have to declare citizenship. You know, I've often wondered this whole argument, you know, because Romney says a corporation's a person. And there's a whole movement to make corporations people who can lie and cheat and steal and do all those things. There's this whole movement. I wonder if we would have to make them declare citizenship, that they're Americans. And if not, can we throw them out and then have companies come in that will declare that they're Americans and sell their products here? I mean, at some point, don't we have to start thinking about this country as ours? You know, back in the 70s, there were a couple of really interesting movies that, you know, talked about, you know, IBM and General Electric and all these corporations. They're no longer countries. They're corporations. We no longer have borders. It's all corporate boards and all corporate run. We're all part of corporations, not nations. If that's the direction we're going to go, I wish someone would let me in on it. Because we might as well get going. Because we're really screwing things up. And I look at the fact that we're handing out billions of dollars in order for these companies, and President Obama's speech tomorrow, I'm expecting more handouts to corporations to try and beg them to create some jobs here. And I'm half expecting him to talk about the Georgia plan, which I think is a bad idea top to bottom. I think it's a failed idea. What it is a handout to corporations. Here's some indentured servants. Here's some wage slaves. Some people you're not going to have to pay. And you can create some more unemployment. If you don't know what the Georgia plan is, it's simple. Real simple. Unemployed workers will go to a company. And this will be a program that the government will set up with these companies. And these companies can sign up to take free workers who will come and work in their factories for free. They'll collect unemployment. The workers will collect unemployment, small stipend to help them cover their costs. The company will get a tax break. and it'll be for, you know, a fixed amount of time. And at the end of the program, the employers can then choose to hire them or not. Well, Georgia's already shown that, you know, 15-17% of the employers actually do hire these folks at the end. Not a great return on investment. I would argue that that plan is going to cause more unemployment. Because what will happen is all those people who the companies are now paying, they'll let go, put them on unemployment, bring them back, have the government pay the stipend, they got free workers. Sounds like a bad idea to me. But you know what? I'm sure Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs should be all for it. And if you listen to this debate, the direction that they want us to go, scary, scary stuff. Privatize everything. Nothing is ours. And I loved how every governor on the stage created more jobs and had a much better, you know, everything than the other guy. And they, you know, kind of snarky to each other, which is kind of funny. But everyone was better than the other one, and they, you know, they were sniffing back and forth. And every one of them had some really negative stuff. But I loved when Romney, you know, was talking about how wonderful it would be to be like Texas. And there's this fascination of making this country look like Texas, with its minimum wage employment, with its high poverty, with its high uninsured rate. You know, we want to look just like Texas. And he said, you know, they've got all this oil, and it's a right-to-work state, and you've got all this labor, and you've got all this stuff there. That would be much easier, especially if you could do away with those pesky unions who keep asking for, oh, I don't know, enough wages to feed their children. And what we would have then is conservative world. And you listen to what they talk about. I mean, it's scary that there are people who sit in the audience are clapping wildly. Yes, yes. We want to make sure there are more unemployed. We want to make sure that there are more without health insurance so that they die earlier and we can save Social Security by killing off the old people. It seems to me what they're saying. If you heard anything different, I'd love to hear it. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. But, you know, the world that they want to take us to, like I've been saying, you know, back to the 1890s, where, you know, children were in the workforce, where you had no maximum hour laws. There was no such thing as an eight-hour day. There was no overtime, none of that. You didn't have weekends. You didn't have any of those things. Health insurance, good luck. Pensions, yeah, count your, yeah, wish in one hand, in the other. See which one fills up first. Sick days, never heard of. Minimum wage, which the Republicans would love to repeal. In fact, they've been all over the fake news on Fox over there saying, well, you know how we get this economy going? Get rid of that pesky minimum wage. And I'm of the mindset to say, you know what, we need to raise that minimum wage because evidently there are a lot of companies out there sitting on a boatload of cash. And we need to get them back into spending money, hiring employees, getting money in their pockets. Maybe the minimum wage, an increase there is going to get more demand. That's what we need to be looking for. How do we increase demand? And this whole solar panel discussion, to me, it should have been about saying, we'll buy them. Not a here's a guarantee. And I read this Rich Lowry piece. I don't know how many people know him. He writes over at National Review, one of those organizations that can't make ends meet. They get money every year from the Scaife Foundation, and they write him a check every year for $1 million to keep him operational. So they keep putting out their spew, so that's constantly in your ear. But he wrote a piece called Obama's Enron. And it's, you know, it's another one of these anti-government frames that, well, you know, the government got involved and they were picking winners, and in this case, they picked losers. And they're talking about the solar industry. And the reality is the American solar industry is failing because of our trade policies. You cannot compete if it costs you $5 or $6 to make something that costs the Chinese $1 and you allow them to bring it in here and sell it. Sorry, you can't compete. So when these three companies went belly up, the right is, they're dancing for joy. This Lowry is thrilled that, you know, Obamanomics is failing. You know, all of the premises are, you know, it's an embarrassing blow that these firms filed for bankruptcy. And I look at it and go, you know what? This is a sad day. And it comes down to our trade policies. You know, if it were one company, I'd go, yeah, okay, it was a bad loan. If it were two, but it's three within a month. And it has everything to do with the fact that we have not invested in this. And the Chinese are investing heavily, heavily in it. And what I found really amazing is that Lowry uses the word Enron. Enron was a criminal conspiracy. These guys did everything in their power to stick it to consumers, to cheat, to steal. They even screwed their own employees by not allowing them to take their pension money out or move their money from Enron stock when the stock was tanking. In fact, they weren't allowed to move their money out of the tanking stock until it had already completely tanked. So all of that money that they had tied up in their retirement and company stock, gone. Never to be seen again. But you know the bigwigs, they knew, and they moved all their money out early. They were okay. The bigwigs were covered. It's the little peons that got hurt. And what he doesn't talk about in his article here about Obama's Enron, he doesn't talk about Enron going around California with rolling blackouts, making up energy shortages. You don't hear anything about that. That's criminal in my estimation. Absolutely criminal. This thing with the solar panels, this is bad policy. Not about the solar panels, but about allowing foreign competitors to come in here and undercut us. That is bad policy. And I know my right-wing friends are going, well, you know, it's a free market. We've got to compete. Let you know just a little secret. You're never going to compete with a country who cheats on its currency. You're never going to compete with a country who exploits its own labor. You're never going to compete with a country who's willing to destroy their environment. It's not going to happen. So this idea and this pandering that politicians do to the American working class, oh, we can compete with anybody. We're the best and brightest workers on the planet. You're not going to compete against 25 cents an hour. You're not going to compete against 16-hour days, 7 days a week, living in squalor. You're not going to compete against that. So you have to have smart policy. Now, I'm not saying we don't engage the Chinese. I'm not saying we don't trade with people. You know, whenever someone hears me say we got to protect our own interests, they always go, oh, you're talking about isolationism. No, I'm talking about protectionism. Huge difference. Oh, well, you're just talking. That's just nuance. No, it's not nuance. When I leave my house, I lock the door. I'm protecting what's in my house. I haven't dug a huge moat with alligators around my house. I haven't put up 30-foot-high electric fences with guard dogs and gun turrets. I haven't done that. That would be isolationism. I'm not advocating that. Now, our friends on the right with the southern border, that's what they want. Moats and fences and gun turrets and lasers and all kind of doodads and whatnots and gadgetry. But we want that southern border open for commerce. We want to make sure those trucks, those Mexican domicile trucks, roll right on through. Because the business party, the Republican Party, the folks who right now are pushing this ideology that we need to be more business friendly, they don't care about you, the worker. They care about the profiteers. And I ask my Republican friends, take your party back. Go back to the days of Eisenhower. When he said, you know, the people who would do away with unions, the people who would do away with Social Security, the people who would do away with all the things that we hold fundamentally true, they're stupid. They're negligible. Make that happen again. Get rid of these kooks from your party. We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Good grief! The genuine populist fury of grassroots Tea Partiers is now being perverted into anti-populism by the very Tea Party Republicans they elected to Congress. Tea Party House members have become the Koch brothers' plutocratic dream. They voted to keep giving a $4 billion a year government subsidy to big oil, to privatize and slash Medicare, to let Wall Street banksters keep ripping off consumers and investors, and to put Social Security on the congressional killing floor. Is this what grassroots voters meant by power to the people? Take Tea Party Congressman Austin Scott. Only you can't. He's already been taken by corporate lobbyists. This Georgia Republican won election last year by waging a full-throated campaign against foreign workers who enter the country illegally. Throw them all out, he ranted. These jobs belong to U.S. citizens. But curiously, Scott did not applaud on July 29th when legal service lawyers won a case to stop a corporation in his district from illegally firing U.S. workers and replacing them with Mexican migrants. Far from applauding, this tough-on-immigrants Tea Party stalwart abruptly shifted sides, favoring the corporation's illegal hiring practices against his own constituents who had been thrown out of their jobs. Indeed, only 3 days after legal services won its case against the corporation, Scott rose up on his hind legs and introduced H.R. 2774, a vindictive one-sentence bill that says, "Be it enacted in Congress assembled that the Legal Services Corporation Act is repealed." This is Jim Hightower saying Scott's hypocrisy is as subtle as a hammer on the head. He professes to be for the people, then tries to kill a program that actually helps poor people pursue justice against corporate elites. Power to the corporations, that's his motto. To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download our podcast at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone and take your class war on the go. You got something on your mind, question, comment, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Or you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Well, I guess it happens to even the CEOs nowadays. Yahoo chairman Roy Bostock evidently fired their CEO, Carol Bartz, over the telephone. In fact, she put out a two-sentence email to all the employees saying, "I am very sad to tell you that I have just been fired over the phone by Yahoo's chairman of the board. It has been my pleasure to work with all of you, and I wish you the best going forward." So good for her. You know, I'm sure there have been times where she has done things like that herself, so I guess the tables have turned. And you know what's interesting? The stock price went up. So maybe firing CEOs, maybe that's cause for stock prices to go up as well. Amazing stuff. You know, earlier I talked about Herman Cain, you know, the Herman Cain train. He's got this great economic plan. We're going to have the 999. It's going to be the triple nines. 9% corporate tax rate, 9% individual income rate, and 9% sales tax. There'll be no estate taxes. There'll be no capital gains taxes. There'll be none of that stuff. It's all going to be the 999s, which means that we're going to have a starving government, which is what the right wants, so that corporations can take over, and we're not going to be able to tax them because they're going to pay 9%. And then they're going to have their lobbyists go and make sure that they get their special breaks and loopholes and all of that stuff. They're going to get their space at the trough. Somehow that's going to make this country a much better place. I'm not so sure. A new study has just come out by a psychologist at the University of Virginia. And the findings, something that, you know, doesn't surprise me, to be honest. The findings are that a more progressive tax system, where you have the very wealthy paying more of a percentage of their income in taxes than the very poorest in society, people feel that they have the best possible life, that they have the ability to move up, and there's incentive to do better. There's incentive to work hard and to pay higher taxes, but also to achieve more. The study analyzed the totals of 59,634 people surveyed by the Gallup organization in 2007 and found that those living in nations with the most progressive taxation elevated their own quality of life higher than those in nations with flat taxes. Now, you know, none of us like paying taxes, and I'm not a big fan myself. But at the end of the day, there are things that we demand as a society. There are things that we need as a society. If we're going to have misadventures in the Middle East, we're going to make big rocks small, we need to pay for that. And during the Bush years, what we did an amazing job of doing is not paying for those things, putting it on the credit card. And only now do we really start worrying about paying about this stuff. You know, you start thinking about the Reagan years. Reagan tripled the national debt. Wasn't much concern about what was going on there. You know, and in fact, a lot of the things that we think about Reagan, what the right keeps pushing and ramming down our throats, is flat wrong. Reagan was a serial tax raiser. He raised taxes 11 times during his 8 years. In fact, 7 of the 8 years he raised taxes, 4 times in just 2 years. So you saw tax rates go up, up, and up on working people. The shifting of the tax burden, the flattening out of the tax code, that really happened during the Reagan years. You know, getting the people at the bottom paying higher. And the tax reform bill of 86, you can go look it up. Lowered the top marginal rate and raised the bottom rate. I mean, stop and think about that. He was never afraid of raising taxes. He did it quite often. You know, he came in with the idea, we're going to cut taxes, then, big holes. So then what did he do? He created, him and Alan Greenspan, smart guy, figured out, oh, gee, how are we going to fill this deficit? Because you know what? He nearly tripled the federal deficits. So what did they do? Well, they figured out how to create this Social Security Trust Fund. And they raised taxes in that one raising, higher than any time in the history of civilization. And they put that money into a little box, and you know what they did? They borrowed from it. They kept borrowing and borrowing and borrowing and borrowing, so those deficits didn't look so big. They were off the books. And now we're paying the price. You know, after his tax cuts in 81, unemployment jumped to over 10%, almost 11%. And that's during the time when the inequality began to really, really expand. When the alligator jaws, if you will, opened wider. And you started seeing the wealthy going up, 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 and the poor and the working class, middle class folks going down, down, down. And as you open those jaws wider and wider, to where now we are back where we were during the Roaring Twenties with inequity in this country. And this whole idea that Reagan was anti-government, anti-tax, is ludicrous. He grew the size of government nearly doubled. But we don't hear much about that. Not much at all. The fact that he gave amnesty to 3,000 undocumented workers. Yeah, don't hear much about that. The fact that he was involved in the Iran-Contra thing. Don't hear much about that. And the bigger part, with 9/11 coming around the corner, it was his administration who helped create the Taliban. It was his administration who helped create bin Laden. Think about that. Because we were funding them to fight the Soviets. And look where we are now. I mean, it's one of these things that makes you have to stop and really think about the messaging that's going on in this country. And if you watch the debates tonight, you know, they gave the big sloppy wet kiss to Reagan. And look, he was a great, great actor. He did a fantastic job of playing the role of president. But at the end of the day, he was not all of the things that the radical right thinks he was. In fact, you know, somebody sent me an email with a clip from Limbaugh saying that Reagan never raised taxes. I guess someone called and said, you know, Reagan told you what I just told you. Raised them 11 times. And Limbaugh knew it. No, he never did that. That never happened. Because we need to rewrite that history to make sure that, oh, well, the truth never gets out. But there it is, the tax reform bill of 86, that all of you folks who are on unemployment, and I've been on unemployment before, everybody who's on unemployment right now and you're paying federal taxes, Ronald Reagan, thank him. Because that's when we started. Do you want a stimulus in this country? I don't hear Democrats, I don't hear Republicans talking about this. Why don't we stop taxing unemployment benefits? Why don't we make sure that that money, instead of going, I mean, think how dumb this is. We give unemployment benefits to help keep people afloat, and then we take money away from them in taxes. Why don't we go here? Pay your bills. Stay afloat. Stimulate the economy. It's just plain nuts, I tell you. Anyway, let's take a quick break. We'll come back with Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
We're sitting at the kitchen table with Tom and his laptop.
My name's Tom, and I'm here today to learn how to save money on my prescriptions with Capital Blue Cross.
Capital's VP of Pharmacy Services, Meenock, is here. She's showing Tom how to use the Capital website to learn his prescription price before he heads to the pharmacy today.
You would want to know what is the cost of that medication to basically stretch your healthcare dollar, because that's your dollar.
The point is, members have options to save time and money. And if Tom wants to log on at 1 a.m. to renew a prescription, that's fine, too.
Having that flexibility to be able to order prescriptions at any time of the day or night is fantastic. And the mail order feature is really like a self-service feature. We love that.
Meenock doesn't usually make house calls, but today she's happy to help.
This is one of the ways we care more, so we do more.
Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you so much.
So the big presidential debate, the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs came to the stage. What'd you think?
Well, I guess I have to tell you that nothing is surprising. I thought they were kind of snippy with each other. They're obviously all decided to go after Obama and Obamacare. But, I mean, would you really want any of those guys to be president?
No.
If I was sitting at home and I was in the middle, not a Republican, but the people that really decide the elections, not the right, not the left, people in the middle, I would say, why would I have any of these guys as president? I mean, I may not be in love with President Obama if I was in the middle, but I sure wouldn't want to replace him with one of these characters.
Yeah, I mean, I look at them, and they're all bad carbon copies of the Reagan myth. All things that they thought Reagan was, that's what they all are, little drones of.
And, you know, I think you have to remember the old adage that most of us, who are in the news business figure out, that these guys, it depends on who you want to invite in your living room for the next in the next 4 years, and I can't imagine inviting any of these guys to sit in my living room with me.
Which is why I got to think that none of them are going to get it. I got to think somebody, and what kind of frightens me is somebody like Chris Christie at the last minute says, you know what, these people are crazy. I'm going to step into the middle of this, and I'm going to take over. And I think he's that kind of guy that, you know, white working class, blue collar people are going to look to and go, he's the guy. He's decisive. He's a stand up leader type. Even if he's going the wrong direction, he's still doing it with gumption and with strength. And I think people are going to be drawn to that.
Well, let's kind of hope they're drawn to it. I think that it's in terms of just his ability to pull it off. I mean, I just can't imagine. I look at each one of these people and I say, okay, it's October in a year from now, and we're at a presidential debate, and Michelle Bachmann is up against Obama.
I'm okay with that.
Romney is up against Obama. What are these people going to come off as?
Yeah, I'm okay with Michelle Bachmann going up against Obama.
Oh, I'm actually okay with any of them because I think the president is going to do very well.
Yeah, well, Romney a little scary about, you know, any of them, because at the end of the day, is as bad as I think Obama has been, he is still infinitely better than any one of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And I you know, my main reason being Anthony Kennedy and Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Well, yes, exactly.
I mean, because I gotta think that the next president is going to have at least two opportunities to replace Supreme Court justices. And if it's a rabid right-winger, we can see two more Samuel Alitos and John Roberts.
Oh, that would be a disaster for this country.
And that's...
I remember when Gore ran, and I went to an event with Barbara Streisand, and she said, I have only two words for you, Supreme Court, and then she repeated it three times, Supreme Court, Supreme Court.
That's it. And, you know, I tell people, you know, my rabid left friends who, you know, seem to be turning into the Tea Party of the left, who just want to hang Obama, I'm going, you know, for all his faults, two decent Supreme Court justices so far.
Right. And if they want to hang, Obama is just not going to hang well, so to speak.
Yeah. What else is going on in D.C.?
Interesting things. One is that the bill to pass the Senate last night with flying colors. I think only three people voted against it or something. The problem is they can't reconcile it with the House bill because one of the things the Senate wants to do is to allow people to allow the patent office to keep the revenues, and then they don't have to go to Congress all the time for appropriations. It makes perfect sense.
But is it constitutional?
But the question is whether it's constitutional. That's the hang up, because is it then considered a sort of a permanent appropriation, et cetera? That is you're exactly right. The question is whether it's constitutional.
Because, you know, maybe I just have this backwards, but, you know, don't they have the purse strings? Don't they decide which agencies get what and all that?
Exactly.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see where that goes. I don't know that I'm in favor of it.
Well, yeah.
Just reactionary.
I don't know where I am on it either, but I do know that it's a very interesting debate. And, of course, tomorrow everybody is getting ready for the big speech. Don't know how long it's going to be on. The White House has been very, very quiet about that. There's been several groups that wanted to meet with the president before the speech. I think he's been actually doing some group phone calls. We haven't had a readout on that, but that's my guess. That's how these usually things happen. They don't want to parade people in front of the White House,
right,
because then everybody starts to ask them lots of questions.
So I've seen $200 million in additional. I've seen $300. I've seen $400. Any credence, any validity to the information?
We're seeing $300 billion, but I have no idea whether that is going to be the number that actually sticks, Rick.
Do you think
we'll be talking to you tomorrow night. I'll give you the actual number. Of course, you'll probably see it too.
Yeah, but do you think this is going to be, because I'm saying he's got to really stand up and do something bold and do what the Republicans are masterful at, throwing that cast way out, knowing you're not going to get everything, but throw it out there and see what sticks.
That would be an interesting thing to do, to say the least. But I think that the president is going to throw some things out there that the Republicans are going to have a very hard time saying no to.
Yeah.
And it's a very smart tactic.
What kind of worries me is that we're going to see him being the pragmatist that he is and saying, oh, well, this is what we might be able to pass, and this is what I'm going to propose, where I'm saying, swing for the fence, man. Do something. You've got to revive some of these numbers and get people looking at you a little differently, I think. Maybe with a little steely spine, maybe a little, you know, a little get up and go, I guess.
Well, I think we're going to be pleasantly surprised. I think the president has reached out to groups, and I think he's going to do something that the Republicans are going to have a very hard time saying completely no to.
Now, and then after he says it, the actual act of, doing it?
Well, we'll see. That's why I'm going to be in the spin room tomorrow night, a.k.a. also known as Statuary Hall at the Capitol.
All righty. We look forward to talking to you tomorrow night at 11 o'clock after all of the fireworks there. So we look forward to talking to you tomorrow night, Ellen. Thanks so much.
You got it.
Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Let's take a quick break. We're right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws and limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standard Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Seems like things are kind of upside down. Joke with you some longer turn around. Oh, okay. He's done it before.
Yeah, he did it before, man. He'll do it again and again and again, whatever the hell it is. He's going to do it over and over until he's done. 1-888-520-RICK. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Question, comment, something on your mind, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So the radical right is claiming the big debate was won by Rick Perry because they can't let Romney win. And, man... Michelle Bachmann looked kind of crazy. The rest of them, you know, just kind of not there. And when you've got 8 people in a 2-hour debate, it's not like you're going to have a whole lot of in-depth conversation. It's who has the most superficial answer readily available. That's the winner. So for sticking to message, give it to the dumb Texan. Pretty simple. Now, the Borowitz, the folks over at the Borowitz Report, they're claiming the victor tonight was President Obama. They're saying a jubilant President Barack Obama said that tonight's Republican forum was the best debate ever, calling it the first good news I've had since I nailed bin Laden. Mr. Obama watched the debate surrounded by advisors, writes the folks over at the Borowitz Report. He was in the White House Situation Room, where the mood was said to be tense up until the first time Rick Perry opened his mouth. Obama said, I'm not a big TV watcher, but that debate had to be the most entertaining 2 hours of television I've ever had the privilege of seeing. Mr. Obama confirmed that he had indeed DVR'd the debate for future screenings at the White House, which tonight was the site of a spectacular fireworks display in the moments after the debate's conclusion. Among the debate highlights, the Republican candidates took pains to enumerate their plentiful broods of children, which added up to a number slightly greater than that of the population of China. And for his part, Governor Perry of Texas made the biggest impression by questioning the existence of Social Security, climate change, earth, wind, and fire. Also notably were his pro-execution comments, which tonight won him the coveted endorsement of the National Association of Electric Chair Manufacturers. Perry went on to say, we don't have high unemployment in Texas, because if you don't have a job, we kill you. And in perhaps the most revealing moment of the debate, Michelle Bachmann explained why she does not believe in evolution. She says, it's really let me down. So there you go. Obama, the big winner in tonight's debate, because, look, there was nobody there. I mean, really, none of the folks there looked presidential. And again, my favorite moment was Gingrich going, we're not going to fight. You're not going to get Republicans to fight. I'm going, isn't that what a debate is? Or am I wrong? Somebody, please, explain to the neuter exactly what he's supposed to be doing up there. Now, they're supposed to be separating themselves from each other. You can't all hold hands. All eight of you cannot hold hands and walk around in a circle singing Kumbaya. You've got to differentiate yourself from the guy or Snow White standing next to you. Pretty simple stuff. And they all had the same exact frame of mind. Cut taxes, deregulate, deregulate, and let the free market, decide. And look what the free market did. We gave the banking industry the opportunity to regulate itself, self-regulating. We undid Glass-Steagall. We allowed the banks to be gambling houses, said, yes, you have learned your lesson. Good bank, go forth and do what is proper. And what they do, they screwed us again. And it's like we never learn. We never seem to learn. And I wish Obama would have done what I would have done right from the beginning, which is break them all up. Regionalize them. Make them smaller so that, you know what, they can fail. What we've done is we've made the banks now bigger than too big to fail. Little sense, you know, little bit. Because there are some free market principles that do work. And this is where the radicals on both sides need to come to where I'm at, somewhere in the same ray, in the same realm, somewhere around the, oh, I don't know, common sense. Say, look, you can't have a bank so big that it has the ability to take the entire economy down in the toilet with it. You can't do that. You can't allow corporations to grow so large that their failure destroys your nation. Can't do that. That's why we have antitrust laws. We've decided monopolies are bad. But if the radical right had their way, we'd have one corporation for every industry. We'd have massive monopolization. It's just nuts. And, of course, you poor people, you'd be on your own. You old people, you'd be on your own. And heaven forbid something bad ever happened, because you would surely be on your own. And I look at this call to action by the folks over at the Heritage Foundation, the Heritage Action for America, their political director, Russ Voigt. He sent me personally an email today saying that while American families struggle with high unemployment and worry about their future, President Obama. He wants more deficit spending. The federal government's disaster relief fund is all but gone, writes Mr. Voigt, after a series of tornadoes, hurricanes, fires, and floods. Washington normally designates new funds as emergency spending and increases the deficit. Now Americans are saying no more. Additional spending for disaster relief must be offset with spending cuts. And I'm going, wait a second. So we're going to take money away from people who are struggling at the margin already to give it to people who are struggling at the margin now. Look, I'm a kitchen table economics guy. Sure, what the heck. I'll go there with you for a short term. Every month we pay our bills. Every month when things happen, we make sure that we have a little savings set aside so that we can do that. We have a little elasticity in our budget to make sure that, you know, when bad times happen, we've got a little cushion. The sad reality, and you look at these disasters, the sad reality is what we have done over the years through Republican ideology, this free market ideology, this anti-tax, blind faith religion, with a whole bunch of bent-knee Democrats. They're not getting off the hook either. What we've done is we've starved government down to the point where there is no rainy day fund, there is no slush fund, there's no cushion, there's no elasticity there. We have to borrow. So when times are bad, we can't just pass the hat. You know what I say we do? I'm okay with not increasing the deficit to help the folks along the coast. I'm okay with that. You know what we do? We go to the next Koch brothers billionaire meeting, and we pass the hat and say, you know what? They need $100 million. You folks pitch in $100 million, $1 million apiece. I'm okay with that. What the heck? This way we don't increase our deficit, and we go to the folks who have the money. Instead of taking it out of the mouths of children, instead of taking it away from education and the future generations, why don't we ask the people who are doing pretty well? The Koch brothers, the Walmart family, well, there. That's where we should be focusing some attention. The billionaire class. But instead, what the Heritage Foundation says, what we need to do is President Obama and his political allies, they don't want to offset spending cuts. They don't want that. They'd rather increase the deficit. That's irresponsible. What's irresponsible is allowing those people who are struggling right now to continue to struggle. What's irresponsible is having politicians out there now saying, oh, we need these offsets, where in the past, when it was their constituents who needed it, they were out there fighting for every dime. Deficits be damned, like Eric Cantor. Voigt continues by saying government grows and freedom recedes when no one is looking. Conservatives must remain vigilant and oppose every attempt to increase this year's massive deficit. Take bold action! So you know where the first couple of days are going with all of this. As Congress is back at work, you know that the Republicans are going to do everything they can do to block aid to these folks. So as they're blocking it, what they're going to do, and the Democrats are going to cave on this because that's what they do, they're going to take it away from children's future. They're going to take it away from food programs. They're going to take it away from the folks at the margin. Because, you know, the people who are suffering right now, the folks who are, you know, their homes are flooded, there's some damage that needs to be repaired, all those folks, they vote at a much higher rate than those poor people with children. So you're going to see this mass moving, I think. I think the Democrats are going to give. But the folks over at PolitiFact did an interesting little piece on the Cantor claims that, you know, he's always been in favor of offsetting disaster funding. And it turns out that they've rated him a full flip-flop because they went back and they looked at the tropical storm Gaston that slammed into Virginia back in August of 2000. And Cantor, he went all out. We need all the disaster funding we can get. We need to get it now. He was hounding Tom Ridge, who was Homeland Security Secretary at the time, for immediate action. We need it right now. He said, time is of the essence, and it is important to start working on this matter so my constituents can receive help in this time of need. He said, issued a news release stating the magnitude of the damage suffered by the Richmond area is beyond what the Commonwealth can handle, And this is why I have asked the president to make federal funds available for the citizens affected by Gaston. He got about $20 million in federal aid. That went right back to his district. And now what he's saying is, well, you know, all you people who are struggling now, sorry, not going to happen. We're going to have to offset that. You folks in Joplin, Missouri, who, you know, 142 people killed back in May. Sorry, you know, we may have to offset that with some cuts. So they've rated it a full flip-flop. And it's exactly what it is. The reality is, in a time of need, we help each other. And whether that means we're going to have to pass the hat at the next Koch brother meeting, or that means we've got to dig a little bit deeper as a nation, we do that. But not on the backs of those least able to afford it. Not on the backs of the future of our children. Not on the backs of our elderly. I'm sorry, I guess I'm just not there yet. Now, there are some, and I've been following this story up in Rhode Island, where a bunch of the little cities up there are having problems because for years they just haven't paid into their pension funds. They kept pushing it off, and you know they did some, you know, your basic accounting numbers, projecting for much higher returns, projecting for less life expectancy, and then when the stock market tanked, everybody's now vulnerable. Because everything we tied up in Wall Street, everything, every guarantee we were making at the time was based on Wall Street never correcting and never collapsing and never doing anything but growing. And now we got these massive pension liabilities. So instead of saying, you know what, we need to raise funds to help pay our obligations, what they're now saying is, no, we're not going to do that. What we're going to do is we're going to cut back on their benefits. We're going to slice them in half. In fact, in Rhode Island, they were talking about one group of, I think it was firemen and policemen, that they just, well, sorry, your pension is now half of what it used to be. And you go, is that legal? Well, evidently, they've ruled it legal in a couple of places, so they're going to try this. They're going to try and have these cities file bankruptcy. So they can just go in and write these pension obligations off. So all these people who put in money all the working lives by less benefit, less pay, they're getting screwed. All because you had this right-wing movement, of this vehement anti-tax movement, who kept saying, oh, we can take that money and we can invest it. We can go to Wall Street and we can invest it. So again, who gets screwed in all this? The working people. The working people. And we're going to hear the same thing here in Pennsylvania. They're going to talk about the same thing here. And it's not only Republicans. I mean, in Rhode Island, it's a Democratic governor. Or the Democratic state treasurer who's pushing this. But it's where we're heading. And it's. And I read one of the comments, and it really spoke to the American frame of mind. One of the comments in the section talking about the story said, well, you know, I don't really care that we didn't put money in during the good years. I don't really care that the stock market tanked. I really don't care. They just need to be cut like the rest of us. And it goes back to, for me, that whole idea of the Stockholm syndrome, this whole idea of a beaten working class, this whole idea of a demoralized working class, where, you know what, I've been screwed over, I've had wages stolen, benefits stolen, conditions have been horrible, I've had it happen to me, so it should happen to everybody. Instead of going, you know, how do we make it better for everybody? We're tearing each other down. Scary, scary times, friends. Anyway, thanks for being here. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. TheRickSmithShow.com, Rick at The Rick Smith Show. We'll see you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the bitter sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous array. Democracy is coming to the USP.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
They are indeed. Hey, Preston, good talking to you. I hope you won't be too long in calling back. Got to get out of here, brother.
You bet. I've got a whole bunch of notes here of other people's comments, and I'll be catching up with you on them.
All right. Well, that'll be wonderful.